Welcome everybody to Roots Reggae Reasoning Sessions. This evening, I'm one of your hosts, Rasaki Maskani, and we have Miss Jen J, godmother of Roots Reggae, and we have Mashariki, and Mashariki is our maestra. Okay, let me tell you who's here with us this evening. We have Brother Stevie here. One of our former guests, we got Ernest McBride Jr. and Clovette Coulter. And we should be getting more people chiming in later. But I'm glad everybody's here to enjoy our guest this evening. I'm going to turn it over to Miss Jen J. And Miss Jen J will introduce our guest. And then we're going to go to Miss Mashariki. Welcome, Miss Jen J. Turn it over to you.
Give thanks, beloved family. It's such a pleasure to be here this evening with the legendary, most honorable Santa Davis. This is walking history right here. So I am so pleased to be able to sit on this panel and listen to all of the wonderful actual facts of reggae music. Sister Mashariki.
And thank you so much. This is a very special day because we definitely have reggae royalty in the house. Mr. Carlton Santa Davis has been an incredible drummer in reggae, ska, and rock steady music. He's played with such historical acts as Bob Marley and the Wailers, Peter Tosh, and many other reggae royalty outside, and other musicians also outside of reggae. So we're very happy to welcome him to our show today. And Santa, if you don't mind, how you feeling today? And can you tell us just a little bit about yourself as an illustrious drummer?
Well, good evening. Santa Davis here. I mean, I don't know. How much can I say? I mean, it's hard to explain. It's hard to explain myself, you know. You would have to go way, you know what I mean? But yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to be involved in this great experiment, in this great mission, you know. Mm-hmm. And consider myself very fortunate to have worked with some of the greatest people within the reggae genre, you know, and worldwide, because there are, I just say, I work with people outside of the reggae music vibe, you know. But my whole life started very early, you know, as a young kid, you know. So my journey started at 11 years old, you know. My musical journey really started at 11, when I was 11 years old, and it was kind of like, you know, I'm a only child, you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Grew up with a single parent, you know, mama, you know, and it's kind of like, I don't know if it was consciously or unconsciously, I kind of decided that I needed something to kind of steer me, you know, mm-hmm. in the right direction. Mm-hmm. So I joined a drum corps. It was actually a Catholic youth organization, and they had a St. Peter Claver, to be exact. Mm-hmm. And they had a drum corps, and you know, I used to go to a school in Maxfield Park Primary, and I used to, coming from school, I would hear, you know, the bands playing and the music playing over there, you know. So this one day, I just decided I'm just gonna go over there and see what's happening. And the gate was actually open that day, because I remember, before I would pass by, I would go by there and the gate would be closed. And you can only hear them marching and playing inside the churchyard. So I just decided, okay, the day when I went there, the gate was open and I went in. And they were that same day they were taking in new recruits. So without even skipping a beat, I said, sign me up, you know, and I just started just like that, you know. But in a weird kind of way, I needed that because, you know, growing up in Jamaica, back in those days, there's a lot of things you could get into. And a lot of the things most likely would have been the wrong things. Because I grew up in a society where, you know, good things are happening, but then also some crazy stuff was going on that influenced a lot of my friends. A lot of guys that I grew up with, they ended up becoming just be plain and straight criminals. You know what I mean? And me growing up with a single mom, single parent, you know, and my mom, you know, thank God she couldn't play the role of a man, but she gave me a lot of disciplinary, I mean, she disciplined me, you know. And thank God I listened, you know. I wasn't disobedient. Not that I didn't, you know, as kids don't be kids. But my whole thing was the reason for doing that, getting the drum corps idea, was to kind of get some discipline on the man side of things, you know. And joining the drum corps was kind of like the military, you know. When you go in the military, you have to stand at attention, speak when spoken to, and I didn't grow up with that, like a man in the house to say, "Hey, boy, do this, don't do that." You know, I never get that. So in a weird kind of way, the drum corps kind of gave that to me. It was you were being disciplined, you were being taught how to obey orders, and you know what I mean, be quiet, speak when spoken to, you know. So, and that it was just a way to get away from not getting involved in crazy stuff. So that's how my life started. But the weirdest thing, you know, me going into the drum corps, it wasn't an idea that, oh, this is gonna be a career part for me. I wasn't even thinking of that. At the time, I was just a kid, 11 years old. So I made a conscious decision to join the drum corps because I figure more or less doing that, it'll keep me busy. Coming from school, doing chores at the house, and then going to band practice. So there was like this routine that I got into. Normally, I would come home, do my little home chores, do homework, whatever. Then I'm out on the street hanging out with my friends, whatever. But then I had something else to kind of keep me in line, you know what I mean? And, you know, that's how it all started, you know? Until today, here I am, you know?
Prior to joining the drum corps, were you exposed to any other type of music in your house? Was your did your mom take you around music? Did you participate in church and music?
No, okay. So when I was growing up, it was a lot of the music was different back then. You had a lot of mento, which is kind of like the folk music kind of thing. Mento, calypso, and of course ska, you know. So you used to hear a lot of that. You see what I'm saying? But my mom, she wasn't. My mom was a Christian lady, you know. So she wasn't the kind of person who listened to a lot of secular music. You know what I mean? I mean, if she listened to music, it would be more like gospel music and stuff like that. So, but I mean, I was exposed to, 'cause we are, back in those days, in the early days, whatever it was growing up, we had one radio station, right? One radio station. And then later on, that radio station, by the way, was called RJR, Radio Jamaica and Radio Fusion, right? And then later on, the next, there was a radio station and TV station that was developed called J Jamaica Broadcasting Corporation. So then you start hearing a lot of news. But the area that I lived in, I live in a place in Jamaica called Greenwich Town. We call it Greenwich Farm. And it was kind of like a fishing area because we had the beach where people used to come in that area to go to the beach to buy their fish, you know. So every weekend, the way I used to hear music back then, because a lot of the popular music never played on the radio, unless it's Calypso or American music. You see what I'm saying? The regular reggae music or ska music or, well, certain type of ska might have been played. But, you know, you have to understand how Jamaica was back then. It was like upper kind of echelon kind of thing. So certain type of music was seen as street music. So reggae music and rock steady and all them things, they wasn't really entertained on the radio station. You had to go to the dance hall. And in my area there, I lived between three dance halls. There was two down the street from me. No, yeah, two down the street and one up the street. And every weekend, Friday right back to Sunday, you'd have these different sound systems that would be playing at these places. So it was a buzz, you know. You had to learn to sleep in that kind of environment.
Oh my gosh.
You see what I'm saying? From every Friday night. So you used to have, like, back then you have Sir Cox and Downbeat, which is Studio One, you know, so Studio One sound system, but it was called Sir Cox and Downbeat. Then you had Duke Creed back then, Duke Creed sound system. Then you have King Tubby's, and then there was a bunch, you know, Jack Ruby, you know, there was a host of sound system, and that was the way you used to hear popular music back then. You know, you wouldn't, the music that they would play, which is regular rock steady, ska, whatever, you wouldn't so much hear it on the radio station. You want to hear, so when you go to the dance hall, you hear your favorite record, the next day, you go Monday morning or whenever, well, people used to buy the records on the weekend. Mm-hmm. You know, people work, so on the Friday, they would go buy the latest record and stuff like that. But you'd have to go to the dance hall to really hear it. Mm-hmm. And that was all.
Okay, then.
Yeah, that was all, you know, the music scene was back then, you know what I mean? And you hear that, you couldn't help but hear it, you know what I mean? So I grew up in that musical explosion. Yeah.
Sure. Mm-hmm. What was there anything in particular that led you from the drum corps to what the next level of music that you played?
Well, okay, so at the time when I was in the drum corps, I mean, a lot of things came to my mind. I was gonna be I had two ambitions, right? I was either going to join the police force or the military.
Wow.
Those were two things that I was gonna join the military or the police force. Well, a friend of my family, well, actually, I had an insurance broker. You know, back in them days, the insurance man used to come to the house, you know, and collect the premiums and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he and my mom, they developed a relationship as far as, you know, customer friend kind of thing. And he knew somebody who worked at the police high command in Jamaica at the time. Actually, at the recruiting station. There was a recruiting place that was over in a place called Port Royal. That's on the eastern side. That's nearby the airport, mm-hmm, in Kingston. The place called Port Royal. So that's where the training school was. So he had spoken to whoever I did, and I was supposed to head the training school at this particular time. But I was, I was supposed to go to this training school. But I saw something horrible one night. There was two policemen who used to do their beat. You know, they used to walk up and down on a road named Spanish Town Road. It was very busy. It was like New York, you know. Everything is happening. Ice cream parlors, movie theaters, everything was happening, you know. And these guys were walking past, and they always say hi, you just wave to them. They kind of like the era police, you know. And they were walking past, and then once they walked past and went up the street a little bit, I heard gunshots. Boom, boom, boom. Only to find out that they shot these two policemen. Mm-hmm. When I ran over there, I even had to help one of the police in a car for them to take him to the hospital. There was this other cop. That's the first time, I mean, it's kind of horrible, but, you know, that's the first time I've seen somebody shot. And the way it was right in the middle of his forehead.
Wow.
And he was just laying there. And when I saw that, I was something kind of clicked like, well, I don't think it's going to work. I might have been about, I think I might have been about 17 or 18 at the time. And when I saw that, I was like, well, you know, and that kind of spurred me on to kind of like move in. By that time, the music kind of chose me. So the first band I joined was a band called The Graduates. And the band leader, he was a saxophone player. And he lived in America for a long time. And he came back to Jamaica. He had a record shop. And an electronic shop where they fixed TVs and radio and stuff. And he had a rehearsal room in the back. And I went over there and he needed a drummer. And I just went in. But I was learning at the time. You know what I mean? I was still learning because that's the first time I actually got exposed to a real trap set, you know? Because coming from drum corps, you only play single drums, like maybe snare, tenor drum, bass drum, or cymbals. So I kind of mastered all those different pieces only to find out, okay, it was kind of a preemptive strike to playing a drum kit which consists of a bass drum, a snare drum, a tenor drum, and cymbals, you know what I mean? So everything kind of lined up like that. So I joined this band, and as I said before, he kind of reminded me of, he had a record shop, right? And everything was right there. And he used to play all these jazz stuff. And that's the first time I got exposed to all these great musicians, you know, the Thelonious Monks and the Rahsaan Roland Kirk and Coltrane and Charlie Parker. And they used to play these things. And because he played saxophone, I guess that's the reason why he was so in tune with that. And I tell you, he reminded me of like a Rahsaan, a Roland Kirk. Kind of. He looked like that. And he had this kind of, when he spoke, he had this kind of draw. You know, like the jazz player, they when they speak, they kind of have this thing, you know. But I learned a lot from him. So I was listening. I didn't really play jazz, but I was learning from listening to all these great drummers, the Elvin Jones, Art Blakey, and Max Roach. And they were telling me these guys, oh, okay. So I got interested. So they were kind of, these musicians, these jazz musicians were kind of like my teacher. I would listen. And then I'd get the records and take it home, put it on my little player. And that's how I kind of learned. You know, I didn't play jazz, but it gave me an idea of musical composition, how things work, you know, how, you know, people work together and, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah. So that's where it all started. And then another note on that, that's where I first met Richard Daley, the bass player from Third World. You know, he was a guitar player back then, but later on he became a badass bass player, you know, working with Third World, you know, and stuff like that. Actually, I was supposed to join Third World in those days when they were starting out. But by that time I was already playing with Soul Syndicate, you know. So as I say, I was with The Graduates, which was kind of cool. And then, you know, I heard that Soul Syndicate needed a drummer. And they were doing a lot of things. So I ended up there. And the cool thing about the Soul Syndicate vibe was that before that, I had a stepdad who used to work at this place called the Public Works Department. And it was kind of like culture, you know, like Caltrans. They fix the roads, fix this. They do all the major stuff on, you know, freeways and bridges and all that kind of stuff. And that's what they did. And my stepdad at the time, you know, that was for a short period because he didn't hang around for too long. But anyway, different story. So he was Fully's father, we call him that supervisor or whatever, right? And that's where the relationship started when I was a young kid. My mom knew them and stuff like that. And my mom would leave me, like if she going to do chores, she would leave me at Fully's house. So there was a relationship before I even joined the band, you know? So, when, you know, once I grew up and all of a sudden they needed a drummer and I went there, did my audition and I was in. So the rest is history. We, you know, from that day to today, we still Soul Syndicate. You know, we do it every now and again. We come together. But that's where I developed. You know, that was like the place that I actually honed my skills, you know, by consistently playing. Then we start doing recording sessions, and we were one of the most sought after group, because people used to love to use us, because we used to, you know, we used to rehearse like there was no tomorrow. So that was the thing that we did. We just get up every day and we would rehearse. Even when we don't have a show, we don't have no shows, we don't have no nothing, but there was something that we did. We got up every day, set the equipment up, rehearse, play for a couple of hours, then we go about our business, whatever. And then we would do that. So because of that closeness and that commitment, we got real tight. So when people come, they would say they want the whole band to go to the studio, you know? And when we do live shows, we used to do a lot of live shows, you know? And we play the records even the records that we didn't play on are recorded. When we play them, people are like, did you guys play these records? No, we didn't. But because we rehearsed, we were committed to doing what we did, we became a tight group, you know? And we made history, both in the live music sector and the recording sector.
And the Soul Syndicate, the musicians that made up the group, could you give their names?
Well, the group passed through a lot of people. Okay, so it was Fully's dad, because Fully wanted to play music. And his dad bought him a guitar, and he was actually playing bass with the guitar, right? Then he bought him a bass and a amp, and then they bought some other, you know, back then they had the credit union and stuff. So they would borrow money from the credit union and buy some pieces of equipment. So it was Fully's dad who actually invested the money because of Fully. And his dad he was a very handy person. So a lot of the stuff, he would make these little cymbal stands, get these pieces of pipes, and he would make some good cymbal stands, because back then equipment was expensive. So if he could make the stuff, you know, and he did that. But he invested because of Fully. And so we had, so the band Fully is really Fully started the band. It was, and his dad really. So it was Fully, and then Tony Chin, and then there was another brother named Cleon Douglas. Actually, before the group became Soul Syndicate, they were called the Rhythm Raiders. And there was this guy, I forgot his name. He actually brought some, I think he brought some instruments, because they wanted to do this group thing. But it's kind of a long story, but it eventually became Soul Syndicate after that. Kind of, the Rhythm Raiders were like, it sounds like some, you know, Rhythm Raiders, like, So they became the Soul Syndicate. So it was Fully, Tony Chin, this virgin called Cleon Douglas, and a couple other people. I don't know. Leroy Osmart Wallace used to play drums. Osmart Wallace used to play drums with them, but he and Fully couldn't get along. So they would have disagreements, stuff like that, because he was kind of like, you know, that kind of person. And then there was another drummer named Max. He passed away many years ago. So they went through a lot of transitions, right? And when I came in the group, it was Fully and Tony and Cleon. Cleon was he played guitar and he sang. And the keyboard player was a guy named Scotty. He passed away too tragically. But that's how the group was, right? So that went on for a while. Then, back in those days, in the early 70s, there was a lot of migration going on. People were moving to England, Canada, the US. So I guess Cleon's parents, they were migrating to America, and he left. So when he left, there was a void. We needed a vocal. We needed a vocalist. So that's when China came, to join the band as a vocalist, but he wasn't cutting it. Chinna is a guitar player. But at the time, we didn't know that. But he came, do the audition, and we were like, no, because what happened, not that he couldn't sing, but what we needed at the time, we needed a vocalist that could sing popular songs, you know? Because we were doing a lot of nightclub stuff and, you know, stuff like that. So we needed somebody who could, you know, be versatile like that. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, when Chinna came, we realized it's not going to work. But then there was a guitar. An electric guitar that we weren't using. And Chinna asked if he could borrow the guitar. And Fuller's dad was really cool, man. He treated, he, you know, his family treated us like their kid. Mm-hmm. Fuller's family, mom and dad, they treated us like we were their own kids. So Fuller's father, we used to call him Mr. B. Mr. B, give Chinna the guitar. I said, yeah, man, go practice with it, no problem. And Chinna started practicing. And he got addicted because, you know, you have to give it up to Chinna. Chinna, you know, he would sleep with his instrument like a girlfriend. Mm-hmm. You know? Chinna, yeah, I mean, Chinna used to play right now. He put a lot of time in. So he came in, we said, okay, we needed a guitar player. So that's how he entered the band, as a guitar player. And then we a couple of other people came in. This a guy named Ferris Walters and Donovan Carlos. Mm-hmm. So now we had two vocalists. We had a full band, you know what I mean? And then when Scotty died, there was a guy named O'Neill Walker. He came and he played some keyboard for us at the time. So you know, the group went through some transitions, you know? Mm-hmm. But once we got the group like that, then that's when that was the first time we actually went to the studios. Bonnie, this guy, this producer guy called Bonnie Lee, he came and he hired the whole band. At the time, we never know anything about sessions and how that works. So he came and he hired the whole band and he paid Fuller's dad some money to hire the band. Like normally you'd be going to a club, they hire the band. So we didn't know about session fees and all that kind of stuff that you were paid individually, you know? But anyway, but none of us care. I didn't care. It was like, studio? What? I'm actually going into a recording studio to go record for Bonnie Lee? Because he was one of the top, you know, record producer in Jamaica at the time. So I wasn't even thinking about money at the time. I didn't care if I got paid. The idea of going into one of the biggest dynamic sounds, that was the studio we went to. I was like, wow, this is like Christmas, you know? So the first group that I ever recorded with was a group called Twinkle Brothers.
Oh, yeah.
Twinkle Brothers, they came from Falmouth. That's where they came from, down on the North Coast. And they were the first group. We recorded some songs with them. And nothing much happened because, I guess, you know, I don't know if Bonnie Lee didn't like the songs. He didn't, there was not a lot of promotion behind it. But one of the rhythm was used, Delroy Wilson did a song on it called Can't Explain. Right? Mm-hmm. A song called What It Was, I Can't Explain. Da, 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 da. But if you look it up, it's a Delroy Wilson song called I think the name was Can't Explain. So that was one of the Twinkle Brothers rhythm, you know? Mm-hmm. And that was one of my first, like, real recording session, you know? And mm-hmm. then while we were recording, there was a bunch of other producers that came to the studio because of Bonnie Lee, you know, he had a lot of, they know each other. So they came to the studio. And while we were in the plane, they were like, who are these guys? And right there, we got popular. Everybody wanted us to come to the studio. They, you know, because we were young. And like I said before, because we rehearsed the way we did, mm-hmm. we were super tight. We were together. There was no helter-skelter thing going on. We were all over the place. Mm-hmm. We were one unit, you know. So now all of a sudden, we started running from studio to studio. You know, we started, you know, you used to hear about these places, but now we are going to Dynamic Sound. We're going to Studio One. We're going to Treasure Isle. We're going to, you know, Joe Gibbs. We're going, there was all these studios that we were, that all these, and Randy's, of course, Randy's studio. What's happening here?
No, he was
Can you hear me? Oh,
yes.
you was pulling up the thing.
Yes.
So we became like a popular, you know, group of musicians on the in the recording scene because they liked how we sounded, and you know, so that was, you know, that was how the whole thing started, and we became, yeah. So the good thing was, we had two things going for us, right? And not at the time, not a lot of musicians had that, because you had musicians who do live shows. They weren't really good in the studio because two different places. In the studio, you have to play more controlled. You're doing a live show, so we had the best of both worlds. We could do live shows, but then we understood the mechanics of working in the studio. So, you know, so because of that, we were in the studio. We did live shows, so we were doing all of that. So we became like a, you know, a staple. You know what I mean? In the We became very popular, doing a lot. So we recorded for everybody who was anybody at the time, you know? And that's how the whole thing started, man.
So you were Soul Syndicate then?
Yeah, Soul Syndicate. Yeah, we,
So
yeah.
when did you become, were you part of the revolutionaries?
Okay. So the Revolutionary was a bunch of people. But it became, I mean, I would work with them sometimes, but they were more like they came after that whole thing. Okay, so check this out. So the Revolutionary actually started at Channel One. But the thing about Channel One, a lot of people, I never really tell people this. I was the first drummer who played for, who actually set up a drum set in Channel One. When they built it, they wanted to see if it worked, see how it sounded, and it was very nice inside. It was like, you know, a lot of they had these things on the wall, like some carpet kind of tile stuff. And so when I set the drums up inside there, it was kind of like the sound was dead. So they started to tear off these things off the wall to get more reflection, like whatever, to make it sound more alive. So I actually played one of the first hit song for Channel One. It was a song called, they call it Jump the Fence. I won't tell you why Jump the Fence is such a thing. Jump the Fence, it was the origin, the rhythm was an original Studio One rhythm called In Cold Blood. In Cold Blood was a Jackie Mattoo instrumental. But Channel One didn't read that they wanted to do it because they had a sound system called Well Charge. So they wanted some kind of music to play to kind of represent the thing. So the Jump the Fence, why they call it Jump the Fence? Now, back in the day when we used to smoke weed, we used to smoke, you know, it was illegal back then, right? We used to have to jump a lot of fence to run from the police. So it was a common thing with Jamaicans. You know, the police, them come on a raid and people have to be jumping fences. And so they call the rhythm Jump the Fence. You know what I mean? But as I said, I did that in the first half, and then once Channel One developed, then it was Sly and this guitar player slash bass player named Ranchi, and a couple of other musicians. Yeah, they came together, and that's how that whole Revolutionary, they call the group Revolutionary, because the thing is this. The producers back in Jamaica back then, they used to have their studio band name. Like Bunny Lee's studio band was the Aggravators. And the Aggravator was consists of me, I was an aggravator, and if Sly played, he was an aggravator too. Because it was different musicians would be passing through. You know, it wasn't just me. I wasn't just a house band or, you know, whatever. But if you play for Bunny Lee, you're an aggravator. Just like if you do one song for Bob Marley, you're a
You're
waiter.
way less.
You see what I'm saying? And I didn't, I mean, I didn't know that. Carly Barry told me, because, you know, when I played for Bob Marley, I played for the Wailers when they were together. I don't know if you remember this song. It's called High Tide. High Tide,
yes,
Low Tide. High Tide, Low Tide, whatever. It was kind of like a ballady kind of song. I think that was the first time I went into the studio. And then we did the original version of Sun Is Shining at Randy's and the Mr. Brown thing, that coffin thing that they were talking about back then, you know? But Carla Barrett was the one who said to me one day after I did those things, he said, you know you're a wheeler, right? I said, wheeler? And I said, no, I'm not a wheeler. I don't play the wheeler. He said, no. He said, Bob Marley said, you're a wheeler. If you play one song for Bob Marley, you are a wheeler. I said, okay. But I mean, I didn't get excited and run around, oh, my wheeler, wheeler. But, you know, it was what it was. You know what I mean? Because you know me, I'm not the type of person to, you know, I don't like doing stuff like that. I don't think it's necessary. But, you know, it was really, man, we could go on for another year talking about this, but I'm just saying, to me, it was really a privilege. It was a honor to actually, when I met these brothers, you know, and find that you used to hear them on records, and then you find yourself rubbing shoulders with the Wailers and all these great musicians, you know what I mean? So, yeah, it's just part of the journey, you know? Yeah, man.
So I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. You know, there's so many phenomenal rhythms that have set reggae.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, like the Starlog 17 rhythm, man. Which one of the rhythms would you say you played on that we would know?
Okay, so Starlog 17, we created that rhythm. Starlog 17, the great Fuller Fullwood. You know, I feel for that brother so much because, you know, he's kind of, he's really hurt by the treatment because we created history. Between Fully and I, we created a lot of history. Gregory Isaacs' first hit song, we played it. All first of the hit song, Love Is Overdue, All I Have Is Love.
Mm.
You know, a lot of Dennis Brown's hit songs, we played them in the early stage, before the Sly and Rabbit thing, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't get no justice. But the Starlog 17 rhythm, I think, I mean, amidst all of the other rhythm, because we play, I mean, you hear a lot of songs that you don't even know that is we play. Because, you know, it's kind of weird. They don't, in Jamaica, it's kind of a weird place when it comes to giving credit, you know? Because you would go in the studio and you play on a bunch of songs. And they would release a song, but if you release a single, then they're not going to put the musicians on the one song. You know, if it's an album, then your name is going to be there. So we played a lot of songs, but the Starlog 17, I can say, is one of the notable rhythms. I mean, that became one of the anthem rhythms. Like, somebody said to me that in England, on the BBC, some announcer said that rhythm was like a anthem, was a Jamaican anthem, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because in America, every one of these, they say Jay-Z, Kanye, all kind of people sample that beat,
mm-hmm.
right? But it was between me, Shina, and Fully. I mean, okay, the bass line, because I don't put myself, I'm just there playing the drums, but I'm part of it. But the bass line is the meat. That's it. The bass line is the the structure of that song. And fully don't get no justice. And he's, and I can understand he being upset and all that kind of stuff. Right? Music like S90 Skank with Big Youth. All those iconic stuff is fully forward. You know what I mean? Just, you know, and Soul Syndicate, you know? But, you know, the Stalag 17 rhythm is one of the more, as I would say, that went international, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And even to this day, you know, Sister Nancy is eating a lot of food off of that, you know? But I ain't mad at her because, you know, she's not responsible. But here's the thing, though, where they don't give credit where credit is due.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody sent me, was it this morning? This morning I woke up and I saw a text, like somebody from Jamaica, they sent me something where Sister Nancy was on the thing. And this guy was talking about how the rhythm was created. Now he's saying, he put up this guy, Winston Riley. Now, Winston Riley, he owned the label that the song was put out. He owned the label. It's actually his session. But check this out. He wasn't even at the studio. He don't know how that... I'm telling you.
What the thing?
He wasn't even at the studio. It was his brother. He sent his brother just to make sure the session went on. But look here. Recording session, people don't know this enough. When you hear about these the so-called producers, yeah, they produce the money and time for the recording to happen. They don't produce the music. They're not like people that, you know, okay, guys who compose and come in and say, okay, I want you to do this and I want you to do that. They don't do that. They just rent, they rent the studio, provide the facility, they call the musicians in, and we now have to figure out what key the singer is in. Then we have to find a rhythm that is going to fit the singer. You know what I mean? We have to do all of that structural work. And the guy, I was listening to the misrepresentation of what a lot of these white guys, I don't know where they get the information from, but they always get it wrong. So this guy is going to put up Winston Riley picture and say, well, you know, this rhythm, Stalag 17, I'm just using words. It was the brainchild of Winston Riley. And they went down to Federal Recording, which is now Tuff Gang Studio, the one on Bell Road, right? But guess what? We didn't record the song at that studio. It was recorded at Ari J. So I had to text back the guy and say, look, friend, with all due respect, that song wasn't recorded. The guy who sent it, not the guy who was speaking, but the guy who sent it to me from Jamaica. Right? I said, with all due respect, my friend, this song wasn't recorded at Federal Recording Studio, which is now Tuff Gang Recording Studio. It was recorded at Ari J Studio. The engineer was a guy named Sylvan Morris. Right? Winston Riley don't have nothing. He wasn't near the studio. He was nowhere near the facility. But you see, they always try to make these guys, and that's kind of the upsetting thing to a lot of us. But for me, I try not to live in the past like a lot of people. I try to, look, the past is not good for me. Because all the past does is damage you. If you keep rehashing it, bring it back. So even though you know, I just say, whatever, you know. I know what I know, but a lot of people hang on to it, you know. Like I said, like my brethren fully, you know, he's hurt. And I mean, rightly so. Because when they talk about people who, oh, well, Ansel Collins, that's the Collins name. He was the only thing, Ansel Collins is the keyboard player who played the keyboard on that song. And he was telling people, it's kind of weird, he was telling people that he told us what to play. But this is what they do.
Ah.
This is what they do all the time. If you record a song, it don't make an impact. Everybody's like, oh, it was them guys who played it. They don't, it was them guys. Yeah, yeah, some idiot song that, right, right, right. But when the thing, when the music becomes something, oh, everybody want to take ownership. Yeah, well, I told the drummer what to play, and I tell. Now, check this out. If you listen to Stalag 17, oh, you might think it's a funk beat or whatever, but listen to it carefully, right?
Sorry, did you listen?
How would that, Marjorie?
Yeah, that sound like Marjorie.
Yeah, tell her to mute the phone, mute the phone.
Man, make I tell her.
Mute your phone, Marjorie.
She don't know.
Yeah, tell her I have to mute the phone. I'll send her
yes,
a
may I try? May I try?
I got okay. it.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is this. Okay, if as a musician, right, I am not above anyone giving me an idea and say, hey, why don't you try this? Can we do that all the time? I'll be playing something and somebody say, hey, Sana, why can you try this? I said, okay, cool. Because that's what we're there for. But I don't like when people try to tell people that you, if you listen to Stalag 17, and Ginger, you can identify with that. I am playing, if you listen to the drums, I am playing Naya Bingi. And the reason why I say that, why I'm playing it like that, because of my involvement with Ras Michael and the Sons of Negus from back then. Right? So, you know, the Naya Bingi drumming is the repeater and the funde and the bass drum and stuff like that. Right? But I am playing the full trap set. So if you listen to the thing, go boom, boom, daki duka doom, bak, daka boom, boom. I'm playing that beat and I'm doing the repeater and the snare, kind of like, if you listen to it, that's what I'm doing. So nobody told me to do that. So, okay, so let me tell you how the rhythm came about. Because you got to know all this. So we did a session that day. We did a session, a couple of songs before that. And I think it was Winston Riley's brother said to Hansel, what? Do a tune, because it was going to be the last song for the day. Do a little song, man. Do something, whatever, anything. Ansel's words were, okay, yeah, man, all right. Play a little rhythm, a little two-card rhythm. That's all he said. That's a little two-card beat. So, okay, so the ball is in my court. The ball is in the musician's court. So I just roll off because what I said before, I said, because the relationship with me and Fully and the Soul Syndicate and China, because we bounce off of each other. So I just start rap, taka, boom, boom, taki. And immediately Fully start playing boom, boom, bagu, boom, 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 boom. Because Fully is crazy. I'm going to tell you that. He comes up with some of the craziest bass lines that you say, where did that come from? Because he was just free like that. Right? So we mimic each other. I'm playing and he's mimicking me. He's mimicking what I'm playing. I'm mimicking what he's doing. So we create this cohesiveness. And that's how, and then China was doing his thing, you know what I mean? And then Ansel Collins, the only thing Ansel Collins, no disrespect, the only thing he's responsible for is the keyboard lines he's playing on the song. But he went on and tell people, oh yeah, man, I'm me tell them what to play. Well, you know what? When people do stuff like that, I say, how can you be so dishonorable? You know what I mean? Because, you know, if somebody tell me something, I'm not ashamed to say that person said do this or that. You know, I am the one who still played it, but I'm not angry or anything. I just listen to people talk, and they try to take away our credit all the time. And I know that's one of the reasons why we talk to Fully. Fully's always upset because about that kind of stuff. Because, you know, we don't get the respect we really deserve. You know. But like I said, for me, I just say, you know what? I don't make these things bother me. I'm comfortable within myself with who I am, you know? You know, I create I create my inner peace. And no one can take that from me.
Rastafari.
No one can take that inner peace from me because it's planted inside of my system. So I just say, okay, people say what they want to say. People, I just say, okay, whatever, you know.
Rashiki, can you play a little of the Starlog 17 rhythm?
It's just a mesmerizing rhythm. If you listen to even the tempo, you know, my whole idea was, okay, we make a rhythm, and I have been a rhythm. You know what I mean? No rush.
No rush.
The whole thing, we've been through some transformation, kind of, them kind of speed it up, you know, in a certain instant, them speed up the rhythm, man, you know. What mm-hmm. I mean, that's no problem. You know what I mean? I can't tell people how to mix their song or how to manipulate, because you can speed it up a little bit if you feel. But if you listen to the song is just that, because they did a remake with Sly and Robbie and them with this big, like they're doing like this big snare sound and all that kind of thing. But this one stands predominant, you know, this one kind of like, because it's not hectic. It's like a chant, you know. If you listen, can you even listen to it? All the rhythm just flowing. It's a chant, you know. It's not, and that's how we approach music. That's my approach to the thing. Mainly because, I've told you before, my life started in the church. So it's still a spiritual vibe. When I play music, the music have to have that spiritual vibe in it, you know. So it's not about being entertainment or hype or anything. It's about doing something that can, you know, uplift someone, you know? That's my approach to the music, you know what I mean? So Starlog 17 is one of them rhythm that it kind of have that hypnotic spiritual energy, you know? Yeah, man.
Yes, all the young hippity hoppers love it, man.
Yeah, man. Well, that's what I'm saying. You know, okay, you see reggae music. Let me tell you my approach to reggae music in Jamaica. The people are the ones, you know, who dictate, you know, how we play, you know. So I used to take note. I don't know if any other musician did that, you know. But my thing is, I used to watch how people dance. I used to watch how them dance and how them move. And the women them love bass line. The women them love the bass line thing. The man them kind of move off of the beat, but the woman them whine. They see them move them, gyrate them hips. So someone said, oh, and even the guy, you might see a guy dancing, a Aboriginal dance, and he just have one move. And I try to find that, what is he dance? What is in the music that is pulsing off of like that? So that was a scientific thing that I went into it. I tried to figure out, what are they dancing after? Oh, is it that little thing where every time the drum do this or the guitar do that or something? So I tried to find, what is that person dancing after? And then once I see that, I said, oh, okay, all right. Can you understand? We human beings are basically rhythmic people, you know. We walk a certain way, we talk a certain way. We dance a certain way, you know what I mean? Even the guy who might seem like he might dance out of time, but he might have something. And I watch that. I even take that to note and say, well, I'm not dancing on the beat, you know, but I like what he's doing. And I would go back to, whenever I go back to the studio to record, I would remember that guy that was dancing out of time or was making that little move. And I would translate that back into the music. So the people in Jamaica are even the little market lady. You see, the car, you know Jamaica, JNJ. You know Jamaica is See, the woman was walking some big basket on the men, and she walked down the street, and she walked, and I read my prayer, and she moved. They said, wow, God, mama. Yes, mama. You know what I mean? And you look on them thing there. So the people, for me, the people in Jamaica, because remember, you know, no matter who you say you are, you know, you can't play music for yourself, you know. It's like when you're cooking, if you have a restaurant, you don't cook for yourself, you cook for the people. Mm-hmm. And you want to make sure, say, you want to make sure that the food, you have, yeah, you might cook your food a certain way, you like it a certain way. But when you're cooking for the public, you have to cook for them. You have to cook to their taste. So it's the same thing with the music. You have to put the right ingredients on the right seasoning, make sure it's not too salty, or it's not too fresh, or it's not too raw, or whatever, you know what I mean? So for me, that was my influence by watching the people. You know, the people do what they do, and you follow. You say, okay, this is how them dance. Because that culture, you know. Yeah. So reggae music is a old culture, you know. Right? Reggae music, you have to understand, come from the people. It comes from the struggle. Reggae music is not necessarily entertainment, you know. Because you see a lot of people that play reggae music, right? You see, I'm a musician, and I don't think they really understand the full significance of the struggle, you know. You know, some people, to some people, it's just entertainment. You know what I mean? Just like even the Rasta culture, you know. Them understand that the Rasta thing is not a style thing. It's not a thing where, oh, you just do it for look a certain way and to fit in. No. Mm-hmm. Because we are man of understand reggae music in Jamaica, as I can tell you, reggae music wasn't respected by a lot of people. A lot of the people you see right now, I jump up and go on like they are so about the music. They were the same ones who used to say, oh, that music cannot even pass the airport.
Yeah.
You understand? They and all of a sudden, I'm see all these people, them are give out all kind of awards at Jamaica. I give out some people, and I say, hold on there. Them are give all these awards, these OD and MD, or whatever you want to call it, to these people. Where were these people when I come to all California, New York, all over, working for nothing? But what were we doing? Establishing. We were promoting the thing. Cause enough time, you remember, you know, enough time we come back to California back in them days, you know, and come working and go back home the same way we come, you know. No money, you know. But we say, you know what? This is for a greater good. This is for tomorrow. This is for the ones them that come in. You understand me, I say?
So the thing is this, yeah.
You understand me, I say? So the thing is this, a lot of people is playing the music now. They wouldn't understand the struggle. They wouldn't understand how much man got killed just to wear him locks. They wouldn't understand how much man get beaten to that inch of him life. You know what I mean? For this music. Because this music was never something that was supposed to go anywhere. Because it was called dirty people music, dirty Rasta music, ganja smoking music. You know, it come from Trench Town, it come from Waterhouse, it come from Rockford, it's not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. And yet still, when them never want to support it, you know, them for the people, I tell you, know, and them know themselves, you know, them never care to support it, because them say, if it have anything to do with Herb and Rasta, long ear man, a dirty music, dirty people music, Bacchawal music, right? But guess what we do? We still say, amidst all of the criticism, amidst all of the degradation and the this and whatever they want to say, we still soldier on. We push it until guess what? Watch it now, Jenje. Watch it now, my family. All over the world. We see
all over the world.
Russian reggae, Japanese reggae, Czechoslovakia reggae. You see me, I say? Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now, this is some people come, oh yeah, you know, reggae music and Bob Marley. Them never love Bob Marley, you know.
Mm.
Remember me, I tell you that, you know. Mm-hmm. All this, you know, for them I run and jump, you know. Them never love Bob Marley. Them never love Peter Tosh. Them never love Bonnie Wheeler. Them never love Burning Spear. You understand me, I say? Because the man there, and I'm not talking about, the meat of the music, you know. You understand me, I say? Right? They never loved the culture because what it was doing, it was creating a concept of reality, a concept of consciousness for a lot of people. They wanted wine, I mean, what they wanted was whiny, whiny music and them thing there. Now, when the man, them, yeah, that used to go on forever because the early music, they may not appear sexy music sing about, you know, but it was, but it was some little, you know.
Golden.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Yeah. But now when them see man come now and them see all of them, but the music has shift this consciousness thing here. What am I talking about? You know, all of a sudden them get scared and they wanted it to die. So they never want to support it. But what we do? We still go out there and thanks to Chris Blackwell, even though enough man I like Chris Blackwell, him take Bob Marley.
Respect him. Respect the man.
But of course, because when him goes on this side, say, you know what, I'm going to invest in a Bob Marley. You know? Bob Marley, I mean, Jimmy Cliff is out there, you know what I mean, but with a different type of music. Different. You know what I mean? Bob Marley go out there and promote the revolutionary music, what Bob Marley was talking about, emancipate yourself from mental slavery. Them things that they never like, them things they are Jamaica. That's why they never like the music, and them say, Rasta music, and them, but it's not so much, them use that as a little thing, but it was the consciousness. Them see people start getting to this. Even some little youth who used to bust them gun and them thing there. The man them start rass up, you know, and come in no whole for those youth. I know them. They're a whole for youth I and I change, you know. Because of the music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The cinema going on the wrong path. I said, Bridget, you have talent, you know. Come put the talent in this thing, man. And a whole heap of youth where you say. So the music come from a place of struggle, a place of despair, a place of where man suffering and him don't know where to go. But the music was the only thing that could soothe him. You understand? So I hope the man him take up a guitar. He might only have two strings on the guitar, but him just find a way to forget a rhythm. And you see them start singing. That's why you see the Wailing Souls and all of these groups. You know what I mean? A struggle them come from. And sure. before them go out there and go do some ranting, them say, you know what happens? To sing some tune, you know. Even though man belly the hungry still, you know. man hungry, you know, belly a roll on them thing there, you know. But a man mm-hmm. say, well, you know what? The struggle is real, but we're going to do something for the greater good. And you see what happened. So, all I like people for know, say, you see this music saved a lot of us. It saved me. It saved me. You know, you look at man like Gregory Isaacs and the man there, and Dennis Brown. It just sad that them leave us the way they did, and they got involved into some things that I wasn't really proud of, but you see, that's the system.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
The system yeah. In Jamaica. But how Una survive that?
That's
how
Una tell.
Survive on that little rock in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean and make the biggest sound?
Because there was a commitment.
I'm blown away.
There was a commitment because I'm saying, when your back is against the wall, you know, you have no other option than to go forward, you know. And the thing is this, you want to make sure for a lot of us who grew up in, you know, with very little, you know, because I never had no rich parents and all them things there. My mom struggled and a whole heap of us struggled. But the thing is this, there was a commitment to do something greater than what we were, you know what I mean? You see what I'm saying? To make an impact. You know, I mean, to be honest, we never really know that the music would have really take the world the way it did.
Mm-hmm.
We never know that, but that wasn't even in our consciousness. We say, you know what? We're going to just ride this thing until the wheel fall off. We're going to spread the message of love because, as I said, there was a time in Jamaica when, you know, back in the 70s, when things really get away. You know what I mean? Political violence and all kind of thing. And the music was the glue, you know. The consciousness was what really saved a lot of people, you know. In the midst of the confusion, a man could have listened to his favorite record and burn a spliff and drink a hot beer and just say, you know what, idiot thing that. You know what I mean? And instead, I'm going to do something crazy. You know what I mean? I'm going to tell you how powerful the music is. Me and China and some other virgin was sitting inside of a yard smoking some herb one day. And you could have walked from one yard to the next yard and go, yeah. So we sit down there, smoke some herb, and China playing guitar. We were at the minstrels, you know. We just walk around and just play music and smoke some herb and thing, visit the friends. And China play, and I hit a buckler or something, I play upon the buckler and with a chant. And this guy, there was a guy who, he come through the fence line. And when him come in, nobody never really noticed him. But you mean, that man, me always have my head on a swivel, you know. You know what I mean? I just the militant vibe, you know. You have to make sure you keep an eye out, you know. So me was that type of person. And I see the virgin, and the virgin come on him like him that move aggressive, you know. And him stop. And we are playing the music. But the whole time him stand up, then I look at me, I look at him through the side of my eyes. I'm like, check him out, you know. And I notice, I see something upon him where never normal, but him stand up, you know. And it's like something grab him, you know. Because we are singing, we are chanting, and nice vibes, you know. Smoke some chalice. I'm going to see the bridge, you know, but no one else not really pay attention to him. So I'm going to see him. And you know, we always stay, we deal with the inclusivity. You know, see a man, say, yo, if we have some food, come eat some food. That's how we stay. I'm going to see the bridge. I'm going to say, yo, Bridging, come sit down, man. And it's like, he'd be kind of surprised to know, say, him get invited. I'm going to say, yeah, man, come sit down, man. Right? And him sit down. And with that smoke chalice and thing, pass the chalice to him, you know. Right? I will pass the chalice to him and burn the chalice. And him sit down there and see him. I say, well, is everything cool, Virgin? What go on? For some reason, I'm going to start getting some dialogue with him, you know. And you know what the Virgin said? That every man just stop and listen, you know. Because with that play. And just by that interaction, the music stopped him. The man say, when me I say, where are you going, Bridging? The man said he was on him way to analyze somebody. him have him gun upon him. Him have him weapon upon him. And him say he was on him way to analyze somebody. And him say something happened that him say he wasn't going to walk that direction. But him end up walking that direction. Something push him to walk this direction. Yeah, that we were. All
right.
I show you the power of the music, you know, and the vibe, you know. And him say, when him come, him say something just stop him in them tracks. Him couldn't pass. And every man just stand up, sir. Every man just sit down. And I listen to this revelation, you know. The man was on his way to go analyze somebody. And just by we sit down there, say, play some music. And I chant him, stop. And then we invite him in. Sit down, Bridging. And the man say he was going to do that. And him sit down there for a while. And the man said, aye, why? It come like a jar, you know. Let me stop your son. Yo, you know. All right, Bridging. You know what? I'm gonna go back home with yard. Him turn back, you know. You understand me, I say? So I'm going to show you, say, it's a lot of things. It show you the power of the music. You know what I mean? We're up on tour with Peter and all the man there. After show, we see a man come crying, the man a cry water. I think it's a virgin. Tears. I say, what I'm virgin? I'm to you. The man say, he was on him last wit's end, whatever. Himself was contemplating and analyzing himself.
Wow.
And him said, someone tell him about the Peter Tosh concert. And him said, Peter Tosh, he never really know nothing about reggae.
Mm.
But the man, somebody tell him about the concert. And him said, all right, this might be my last concert before I do what I ever do. And him said, when him come at a concert, him said something just changed him right there. And him said, him realized that life is very important. And those devil thoughts that was in him just immediately evaporate. You see what I'm saying? So this is why I'm sure you say, the music come from a place where the music experience aggressive behavior, hardship, negativity. But out of that same music comes positivity, because a lot of lives change because of the music. So anyone that play reggae music right now and think it's just entertainment, it's far deeper than that for me.
You know what I mean? I was at that Greek theater show. It was my very first, as a matter of fact, it's the first date Garty take me on. And it make me know Peter that night. I was sitting in the audience. You see, when Peter play Mama Africa, I just started lick some jump. Me just start crying, you know. The place sold out. And Peter just have the place singing Mama Africa. And I turn around and look at all these white people. It just start bawl. We couldn't believe it.
Okay. Let me tell you something now. You see, working with Peter Tosh was a magical thing. Because it's the only time, I can tell you this, it's the only time I ever have, you hear people say, them have out-of-body experience. That only happened to me when I played Peter Tosh. And I never felt that with no other group again. Because there was a mission. There was something that was way, way different. It was serious, because Peter Tosh wasn't an entertainer. You know? He was a messenger. He was a revolutionary. He was an instigator of consciousness. You know what I mean? And you really felt that. Because I would watch videos. I would watch videos after shows, and I'm making these faces and doing these things. I'm like, when was I doing that? I'm looking, but it was real, because I can remember one night I was playing, and after I finished and got up off the drums, I wasn't lightheaded while I was playing, but when I got up off the drum, I had to catch myself, because I felt like I was kind of floating. So I had to catch myself. I was going to fall down. And right then I realized, whoa, you always hear people talk about you're there, but you're not there. You know what I mean? You kind of like, you move to another level of consciousness. And it's only because there was you're getting that spirit there. I wasn't taken over by anything. It would just mean naturally moving on a level where, you know, the consciousness was so deep, you know what I mean? Where, you know, it wasn't just me just playing, trying to be cute, you know what I mean? It was serious, was deep, like deep meditation then, you know what I mean? And that was the thing for me, and I realized the impact. Every time we would play, people would come and reveal, oh my goodness, I was just saved, I was just this. My mind is clear. Oh, you guys did this. And I'm like, wow. And then I realized how serious the music really is. It's bigger than just, you know, drinking some beer and, you know what I mean, dancing. It's more like a spiritual awakening, you know what I mean? You know? And it's because of where it coming from. Because people like Peter been through a lot before what happened. You know, Bob Marley, the same thing, Bonnie Wheeler's, you know. Every man in Jamaica got you something. All of these brethren who could have easily take the wrong path. You see what I'm saying? But what they did, they said, you know what? We have a voice and we're going to speak for the people, even to the detriment of our own self. You see what I'm saying?
Definitely.
They were the vice for the viceless, you know. And they took that plunge, you know, and didn't really, you know, care whether or not somebody liked them or not. They don't. They just gonna speak the truth to the people and who cannot speak it, you know. Yeah.
We have some people on the line that we'd like to see if anybody had any questions or comments before we go any further and walk into your career with the great Peter Tosh and your spiritual experience while playing with him. So is there anyone with us right now that would like to ask a question or have a comment? Speak now. Okay. Well, let me just make a comment. Jamaica also happens to be the home of Marcus Garvey, which was our first introduction on that level of, you know, being self-determination for America, especially. He didn't make it as far as, I don't think, California, but we still, to this day, there are Garveyites, and the things and the principles that he taught still live on. I would say that was like the beginning that kind of like maybe led reggae to be spiritual. I mean, I feel like Jamaica's always been kind of a spiritual, magical island because it's much more sensitive to the needs of people's heart and what it is that they feel than maybe other places because of it being small and being the home of reggae music and Marcus Garvey. So what do you feel that there's a kinship of Marcus Garvey's philosophy and the birth of reggae music coming out of Jamaica?
Of course, because you have to understand Marcus Garvey was one of the first Jamaican who talked back to Africa. He was one of the men who said, we must organize and centralize our thing. You know, basically, the words they hear Martin Luther King said, pull up yourself by your own bootstrap, are the same philosophy that Marcus Garvey had, you know what I mean, for us as a people. You know, so for me, who grew up learning about Marcus Garvey, I mean, some of the younger artists, if you ask them about Marcus Garvey, they wouldn't even know what you're talking about. You see what I'm saying? But that was the catalyst for people like Bob, Peter, Burning Spear. Because we know just Burning Spear sing a lot because that the inspiration, you can't forget that. I mean, Marcus Garvey passed away long, long before none of us was even born. Mm-hmm. But the people who rolled with him, some of them were still alive. And, you know what I mean? I ran into a bunch of Garveyites who, you know, some elders back then who kind of give it and say something that your head starts swell, like, whoa, really? You know what I mean? So a lot of us who, you know, get some of that knowledge, you know what I mean, the philosophies and the opinions of Marcus, you know, Messiah Garvey, you know, I think that's a great example. That was a great example that was laid down. There was a pathway for people, like, so that's why it's so serious to me, you know. I don't know about somebody else, but because I learn and remember the people who spoke about Marcus, who actually rolled with him, you know, who knew him, and, you know what I mean, from that time, you know, from elders, you know. And yeah, that was a great part of the struggle. I think that was something that was, you know, maybe subconsciously in the minds of ones and ones, because we used to talk about Marcus Garvey. Marcus Garvey was on the lips, is just later on society start change and them start teach those things in schools. Can we learn those things in schools, you know? Mm-hmm. Them used to talk about Marcus Mosiah Garvey, them used to talk about Paul Bogle and the Morant Bay Rebellion and them things there, you know what I mean? And then it's later on now when I realize the influence that Marcus Garvey had in America and a lot of the civil rights leaders, you know what I mean, the John Lewis's, the Martin Luther, the Medgar Evers, and all these people. I'm starting to,
the Nation of Islam.
The Nation of Islam. Wow. Okay, this is deep. You know what I mean? So it's so tied in, you know what I mean? And this is why, you know, my level of consciousness to the truth have to stand firm, you know? And you learn from the people who set the example, you know what I mean? And you have to respect that, you know? A lot of the younger artists them today, that don't really appeal to them, you know what I mean? And that's the sad part about what's going on today.
And
I was talking to Carl, what's his name? Carlton. He's a white guy. He's a journalist. And he was telling me that he's so frustrated in talking to these young artists because their head is so swelled. You know, he feels that this is happening due to social media, but because they don't even understand the rootical Rastaman that sacrificed to set this music and did it for the purpose of setting the standard. He wasn't thinking about getting paid, wasn't thinking about being put in the history books, but yet the work that Uno laid down is phenomenal.
Okay, so, all right, check this out. You see, just like I said, when I was younger, when we were younger, you used to hear, like, because I grew up in the 60s, a 60s child, right? Back in those times, you used to hear a lot about these people. You used to hear about, there were people still talking about Marcus Messiah Garvey, right? So we people from the 60s coming up to the 70s, right? You see, right at the 70s, everything kind of cut off, right? So because you have a section of society, you know, where even to this day, you know, still want us not to know ourselves, you know. Still want us to be slaves, still want us to be dumb and not have any wisdom or any knowledge. So what you see up now, there was a collective effort, you know, by some people, you know, to eradicate those type of teaching. You know, see? Them kind of systematically rub those things out of the curriculums in schools, you know. Like you remember back in the day, we used to have devotion before, you know, every morning we have devotion before classes, and then later on the year people say, oh, we have to take this, we have to stop the prayer in school because you know, some people might get offended because some people might be Muslim, some people might be Buddhist. So I said, okay. So if that is the case, then why not have silent prayer? Still have the devotion, but don't have to, you know, appeal, you know, say one thing. We know it's the same thing, but all right. So at least there can be some connection to the Godhead, whichever language a man say, you know what I mean? Because we know it's language, you know, and ideologies, whatever you want to call it, you know. So just keep it silent. At least there is reverence to a higher power. You know what I mean? So them systematically rub those things out of the youth them and kind of bury that culture. The culture where we grew up in and the knowledge and the understanding that we used to get from hearing about Marcus and all those other freedom fighters who stood for something. You know what I mean? Right? Even the first man we talk about, Rastafari in Jamaica, who never had never just a jedlock, like, whatever, Lester Oil,
someone Leonard.
Like that. Leonard Oil, right? And I talk about, and all of those people we learn from, you know what I mean? But what really happened, because them want to control, because you can't control conscious people, you know? Right? See, you see, when Bob Marley was singing certain things, when Bob Marley said, don't make a politician grant you no favor because him always want control forever. Them never liked them things there. Because when Bob said those things, when them say, get up, stand up for your right, you know what I mean? Them never want to hear them things there. So that's why they were very happy. Now I tell you, some people were very happy when Bob passed away. Some people were super happy when Peter passed away. They never really worry about other people, you know, because if you notice what's going on, Jamaica is a herb country. From when I grew up, man does smoke herb. I used to have a rum drinking section too. You have guys that love get drunk on alcohol, which is the, in Arabic them call it alcohol, which have the devil. You know what I mean? Right? So you have a rum drinking section of people where all of the drink them go to a rum bar, and you have the conscious people them who just smoking because spray for them chalice or whatever. Right? But the thing is this now, that consciousness was disturbing society. You understand? So what them do? If you notice right now, in Jamaica, the whole thing changed to a super materialistic society amongst the artists.
Very American.
Right. You know what I mean? It's like, you can't tell them you to, oh no, consciousness. Come on, I say, well, the conscious music thing was from Bob Marley them time, you know. But the people have now buy them thing there. And I'm like, really? So that is the mentality. You know what I mean? So when people speak like that, now the devil steps in. Because what I said, the devil is the guy, the system that controls the stacks of dollar bills, right?
Babylon.
You see, all the youth them behave, you know, them have stacks of bills and them start show it certain way. And, hey, you know? Don't realize that them don't have anything, but it's a way of control the mind. So as I say, them can't control conscious people, so they have to weaken you. So I can tell you the way all the music is right now. Them just come in with a set of people who come in with some influence and say, you know what happened? If we can pay them guys there for sing some derogatory thing. Cause look at the shift. Look at the shift. From what was going on in the 70s and the 80s, where you have Bob and the Monday and Peter. And some songs that you can't even listen to them.
Yeah.
The women, if you look on the women, they must show everything upon them body in a way that never used to happen. Yeah, let me suggest. What you call it? Let me suggest sexy. But no, it's not sexy anymore. It's revealing. Yeah, no, you're right? The man them same thing. I wear them pants. I drop them at them ass, so you can see them underwear. And you say, "What am I so we used to live?" You know what I mean? And you look and you see, yeah, you see some man now. Watch it again. I tell you, I see the whole thing, right? And you know it's true, matter. Back in the day, when you see a ras with a little buckle or a cup, it would be roots. It would be a roots drink. Mm-hmm. But now when you see man in big long dreadlocks with that same thing, that's alcohol and a big spliff. So it show you the degradation, it show you the level of unconsciousness we're going on. Mm-hmm. And only because a man says, yeah, man, you can't drink just okay, you see, and you see, man, things that I never used to see as a youth I grew up. Mm-hmm. Me, I see junk in Rasta tumble on with big long locks on the ground. Right? Well, because there is that effort. There's that collective of people who want to kill that. Them don't want no consciousness. Them want weak people. So if I can give, if, kind of, you am the Jamaica now. I'm not telling you, Jamaican, I can't tell you what Jamaican people say. Jamaican people are extremists. They can be extremely good or extremely bad. When Jamaican I drink them drink a whole heap. The man has to drink crates of beer. The man has to drink one little six pack, you know. The man has to drink crates and a 24 beer in one case or something like that. And you have man that drink that, right? Now, the thing is this, people can go either way in a Jamaica. It's either a man can, you know, refuse certain things and just accept it and go the whole 9 yards with it. You see me, I say? And that's the problem right now. You know, everybody want to be, just like you say, we set a precedence in Jamaica. Where the rest of the world want to talk like we, them want to dress like we, them like our food now. cuisine start at, you know what I mean? But the thing switch. The man them start follow what them see the rappers them do in America.
The young the people. Young people.
Right. But the thing is this, can you blame them? Because there's no one teaching them. Because the people them are supposed to teach them. Because I remember this, you know, when me I grew up as a youth, you know. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You have some Rastaman, the elders them was disciplinarian, you know. You can't go around them, man, they with no foolishness, you know. You see me as a now, the people who supposed to set the example are the same ones who are doing the foolishness. So the youth them see that now and say, then wait, all them big jed there, I drink NSC and cognac and them thing. You come and tell me some of it if we just be Irish and country. Oh, so them get so the disrespect start from the song. You understand me, sir?
Yes.
You know, okay. You have never look. I have done many stage shows in Jamaica, and back in the day, you used to have the artists them, the Ken Boots, the Delroy Wilson, the Alton Ellis, the Joe Higgs, the Wheeler. You name it, all of them artists them. And how I used to see those brothers behave, and the sisters them, to Marcia Griffiths and Judy Mort and Sister Rita, and you know. Those people used to compliment each other. When an artist would go up on the stage, they say, "Go on, go in there, boss. Yeah, man. Go kill the boss." Hey. It was just encouragement. You would never. If them people have any differences, you're not seeing it. Them now could go up on stage, go tell man about them mother and all them things there. Right? So now, these new crapper artists within the thing, you see them go up on stage. We see all the big ones, anyway, Sizzler and all them. They're on big stage. And I tell them about their mother and big fight on stage. And the youth, them see them thing now. And I say, what kind of example are you setting? Because you would have never seen Ken Booth and Derrick Wilson fight on a stage, or Alton Ellis, or John Wilt, or none of them people. They encourage each other to do. They were a tight group of people. They were different. Yes, they might have differences, but you would never know that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they were super perfect people like, oh, pristine. Mm-hmm. They're a human being. You know what I mean? But you would never see them go on stage and degrade the culture like that.
I was going to say, I just wanted to back it up just a little bit because you did express the fact that working with Peter Tosh, first of all, he was not an entertainer, even though lots of people thought they were being entertained. He was a very spiritual and with a message, you know, he was a messenger. At what point did you make the transition? I'm only going back because we left off.
No, yeah. Okay. I was kind of like going at it.
That's okay. And the other question is, reggae music is spiritual music, and the drum and the bass is very important. Can you talk a little bit how they have now started to use the bass for bad and not for good in the music, how it can affect people a different way and not a spiritual way in today's music?
Okay, frequency.
Yes.
Frequency. So music, sound, we talk about sound and frequencies. Now, long ago, the tuning, let me tell you something. We're using 440 hertz. The original tuning is 432. The 432, when you tune the instrument at 432, that is the spiritual realm. After it gravitates to the spiritual side of life. Right? And I think it was back in the 50s, I think, if I can remember, they realized they wanted something more aggressive. So what happened? Them changed from the 432, which was more spiritual. That's why you see things evolve over time, you know, to where it reached, you know. It never just get like that overnight, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was a constant feeding.
Mm-hmm.
So when them go to the 440, you know, the 440 is more abrasive. It more, you know, you can drop the frequency now to the lowest level. So with the bass, when you drop the frequency so low, that just if you notice, sometimes you hear some guys driving past in cars, and the bass is so low that it actually have a buzz in it, a buzz, like a boom. Right? That's what them say. That's the devil's frequency. And just a case in point, there was a show, and I've seen a lot of shows like that, but there was a show with that guy named Travis Scott, where there was a stampede and people got, stamped on and whatever.
The rapper.
The rapper, right?
Yes.
And this girl, she was doing a video leaving the venue. She said, she was hysterical. I gotta get out of here. I gotta get out of here. Cause something is going on. Da, 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 da. And she said the bass is so low that she said people start acting crazy and stuff like that. And people start complaining of severe headaches and stuff like that. Now, music don't really give you a headache unless you put your ears so close to the speaker. You're gonna blow your ears out, right? But the frequency, if it's there and you are there, our body responds to the frequency. And when the frequency get that low, that's when the spirits can come in, because now you don't have any control. You see what I'm saying? So frequency, there, like they say, the C chord. They say the C chord in music is one of the more spiritual chord, That's why I like the song people them have the C chord all the while. Them singing in C. Huh?
CEG, the three or which chord? CEG.
They're kind of in that, okay. Those are spiritual energy. You see what I'm saying? So the thing is this, even though, Peter and Bob, they got away with because their intention, even though they were using 4/5 tuning, but their spiritual intention was intact. So, I mean, we weren't going to push the bass frequency down there. It's going to be heavy. It's going to be heavy, but it's not going to reach the point where it starts to give you this buzz. You see what I'm saying? But this is part of what is damaging a lot of the youths, their mind now, and especially the dancehall thing, even the way our dancehall music, and it sounds like everything is going fast and everything is like hectic and a bunch of stuff going on. Those are different frequency patterns that people feed off of, and they don't have any time to calm down and think. You see what I'm saying? Because like with Bob and Peter, maybe if they were doing fast rhythm like that, maybe it would be something else. But if you notice, Bob was like a feel it in the one drop, and it was more like, this laid back Naya Bingi vibe, and that's what they were doing. The Naya Bingi, which is a spiritual, the spiritual drumming and the vibe, that is what saved us. You know what I mean? But basically, tuning. That is the 4/5 the earth is really the killer. That's where the devil lives. You know what I mean? So I have to go back to 432. But a lot of people, they know these things and they don't want nobody to know. That's why they changed it. Because I work with some people. I work with people who use the 432 tuning. And I'm like, wow, there's something about, the music. There's something spiritual about, you really feel it. You know what I mean? There's something, And they did tests. They did a lot of tests, like with water. They play the they use the 432 with water, and they see how the water just be calm. And then when they go, they use the 440 Hertz, the water just got crazy. Same water, you know what I mean? So there is something in it, There's something in it. If that makes sense.
No, that makes a lot of sense, and it's very subtle. I
Yeah.
mean, people do not know this, and they're listening, and they don't know about frequencies and effects that it can have on the body and the mind. Then it just especially goes over their head. They
Yeah.
can be being led to do things almost like mind control without even knowing that that's taking place because they're not familiar with it.
Right.
It's not being talked about. There's no point of reference that is being highlighted or anything. It's almost like a secret. That like a Pied Piper,
Right.
follow this beat over here and it'll lead you to not a good life follow this energy over here, spiritual, and it's going to open up some beautiful opportunities for you, make you feel a lot better about yourself and how you fit in the world. You see people as human beings, you have a heart. The other way is you don't have a heart, you don't really care.
Yeah, well, another damaging thing right now is alcohol. And a lot of kids are drinking. They're drinking these drinks. They don't even know where the drink come from, right? So alcohol is another damage. And there is things that they put in. Notice how people are behaving right now. I would encourage people, anybody who smoke weed, smoke herb, I don't call it weed. Anybody who smokes, be careful where you get your smoke from. Those dispensaries are dangerous places. Cause I don't have any proof, but I heard somebody said something the other day that they're lacing. People are buying their product from people, and they're lacing these things with fentanyl and all these kind of chemicals. You see what I'm saying? And if you notice, I've been noticing a pattern with people. People are doing some crazy stuff right now. So the kids, especially the kids, you know, because they're drinking and they're smoking. And a lot of people are having brain damage right now. So I would encourage people, stay away from alcohol. Stay away from some of these dispensaries. If you can find somebody up in Humboldt or up in Oregon who plant the weed in the field, far away from people, try to get the herb from them people. But don't be going to the dispensary around the corner. Because they don't know who they're getting stuff from. Because, can you imagine? Herb, which is something that a lot of people despised. They despised herb. And all of a sudden, everybody's in the business now. And all of a sudden, dispensaries all over the place. Oh, okay, all right. Maybe this is a good way to capture. Can you see what I'm saying? They can't control conscious people, you know. You got to get weak people. But, oh, they like certain, oh, they love the herb. Okay, all right. These dispensaries, these herbs are not being grown outside. They're what do you call it, hydroponic, inside hydroponic, some building, yeah. with a bunch of lights and whatever, you know, saran wrap, all these kind of things, try to create heat. No. You see what I'm saying?
They don't get sunshine. They get pesticides. They don't wash exactly. The pesticides off. They let it dry. People smoke that, and they have other things, maybe skin outbreaks and other type of things to let them know this is not pure. It's not.
Yeah, so not so they're just so many. It's not just one thing, but there's a bunch of things. And if we can eliminate some of these things, I try to. I mean, you can't really eliminate it. But you can eliminate it from yourself and try to encourage others. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know? But just like I'm saying, man, it's gotten harder, you know what I mean? Because, you know, people right now get so used to, you know, certain things that it's hard for you to tell them, you know, hey, you know? Hey, you tell people, hey, man, don't do this. They're like, well, I'm a grown-ass man. I've been doing this all my life. I'm like, okay. You know what I mean? So, but we still have to try to help who we can help, you know. But the music has been the thing that I see, you know, it's got negative impact and it also has positive impact.
It seems as though you've made sure to stay on the positive in a more spiritual type of musician, not entertainment, not popular, but spiritual. No. And when you were playing with Peter Tosh, you said that was when you actually had a really, you could really feel the spiritual energy of the music, and it affected you personally as the drummer. Can you elaborate a little bit on how?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is this. Because what he was singing about, what he was, the words he was using, it wasn't something that was made up. It's part experience and part of, because look here. People didn't know this about Peter and even Bob, but they used to read a lot. They didn't just sit down smoking weed every day, you know? Of course, that was a pastime. They smoked. But they used to read a lot. They read books. So, you know, knowledge-wise, they were like in tune, you know, with things. They were in tune with what was happening in the world, you know? And just like I said, the word apartheid, a lot of us Jamaicans didn't know what apartheid. So when you start talking about apartheid, we didn't know what it was until we realized, oh, okay, that thing that's going on in South Africa with all that, you know, segregation and the just the old system. It's an apartheid system. It's a system that oppresses people and this, that, that. That's when we say, oh, you know, because even Sly Dunbar said it one time, like he didn't, he's hearing this word and not understanding. Apartheid, what is that, you know? So a lot of us didn't know, but the thing is this, because Peter was so deep, and you're talking about in the early 70s, we didn't hear people use, you didn't hear people use words like that in Jamaica, you know what I mean? So these brothers, they were really on top of things. So when they sing, they had proof, they had facts that they were working off of. So that got me into believing, okay, this is a good mission. So I'm going to do it with all my might. You know what I mean? You know, I'm going to get involved. I'm not just there playing and trying to be cute or anything. I'm feeling it too, you know, because, you know, it was part of making it real. You know what I mean? Because then I realized it wasn't really entertainment. It was said to me. It wasn't said to me. I felt it. I felt that something was really real about what we are doing. And then when people would come with their different revelations, I was like, wow. So we're really doing something that's positive. You know, we're doing something that really affecting people in a positive way and a spiritual way, you know? So in that way, I get to let myself go, knowing that what I was doing, I didn't have to tense up anymore. You know what I mean? I freed up myself. You know what I mean? And that's why I tell you, I would have these outer body experience, kind of. I'm conscious in what I'm doing, but you felt this thing where you felt light. You were floating. You know what I mean? But you were still effective. You see what I'm saying? So, but I haven't felt that since. And I'm not saying the people that I work with don't have that, but it's different. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because the thing is this, with artists today, they have to be careful now. They kind of mince their words. You know, they kind of like, okay, I can sing about oppression, but I can't sing about it too much. Mm-hmm. I can't emphasize on it. With Peter and Bob, they just said it like it is.
Yes, I loved it.
They didn't try to sugarcoat nothing. You know what I mean? So there's a difference. All these guys, we see now talk about revolution, and it's just words. It sounds good, but they're not about it. Because they're the first ones to run behind the wall. You know what I mean? I said, well, I'm just singing some lyrics. That's what you hear them say. You know what I mean? If it gets to the point where they have to stand up to something. You know what I mean? You know? Can you look at all the artists them today?
They standing up for the dollar. That's it.
Exactly.
They get endorsements and all kinds of things.
Hey, this is a perfect segue into what I want to ask.
Yeah.
First of all, brother, I'm really enjoying your history here and your teaching. You know, reggae music for me, and I'm so blessed to have met Mashariki and Jinje, even though I should have met them years ago because we all from Long Beach State Black Studies Department and right. BSU. Yes. And, you know, reggae music to me is the pure soul music. Mm-hmm. It's really soul music. Yeah. And it captured minds back in the summer of 1983, mm-hmm. listening to Bob Marley on a consistent basis, just the one cassette tape that I had. And it was the last one, you know, Black Man Redemption.
Okay.
You know, and all of that. And I mean, it did something to me spiritually. And so I've been a fan, and I'm just overwhelmed by it. Like Jen Jay always say, reggae mellitus.
Yes,
I have it.
Yes,
but
I haven't been right since.
So what I'm just probably a few years older than Ziggy, and I'm right there with Sharon and Sadella. And I used to listen to the Melody Makers all the time. And I mean, they became the family, and they didn't know I was family. That's how much I was into it. Yeah. I want to know, how is it working with Ziggy?
Well, it's kind of the same, because his music, what I like about it, it might not be as old Peter or Bob would do it, you know? But his music, the one thing with Ziggy, his writing skills, it makes you think. His lyrics, that I would like, wow, I wish I could write like that, you know? Because he put things into context in a way that makes you think, you know? And that's cool, and that's what I like about him. And his music is also on a conscious level too, you know, just in a different way, you know what I mean? But it's still conscious, you know? So it has the same impact. Look, it's gonna be hard to do what Peter and Bob did. It's kind of like, that was just a one and done, you know what I mean? You know? So you have to kind of do, and Ziggy, I mean, Ziggy's doing a great job at what he's doing. You know what I mean? You know, people love what he does, and you know, and I feel good working with him, because I know I'm working with someone who you can. What I love about his music, you can bring the whole family. You don't have to worry about, oh, you're gonna hear some expletives or some derogatory terms or something. You know, so. His music is really, really on the conscious level. Yeah.
Most definitely.
Really conscious.
Most definitely. I love Justice. That's the song that really hits hard. Justice.
Yes.
Yeah, so thanks a lot for that.
Yeah, man. Yeah, man. Conscious. There's consciousness all the way. And just like I said, I could have worked with a lot of people, make a ton load of money. But I said, look, I think integrity first, you know? Morals first. So I say, you know, yeah, I can make a lot of money working with these people, but how am I going to feel? What am I going to tell my grandkids and my great-grandkids, you know, why I was working with that person who's acting like that and who's talking like that? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So for me, that is very important, because my whole thing is about being a good influence to the young ones that are coming up. I don't want to be a part of the problem or the issues that's going to make them turn and do the wrong thing. I don't want to be a part. I want to be the solution, at least somewhat, you know?
Well, I can't save everything, but I want to be. I have to say that I would love when Santa would take that solo. When it's towards the end of the set, and you will lick some drum, boy, and fling your locks and play. And it seemed like you do a whole next set.
Right, that was something. And it happened. It's kind of weird how that came about. I did it one night, you know, because we finished. And for some reason, I just started, you know, hitting the drums. And then Dennis Thompson, who was an engineer, he started doing some things. I said, okay. So I went ahead and do it. And I did that the first time. And then the next time I didn't do it. And then somebody said to me, what happened? What happened to the drum solo, boss? And people were like, drum solo, what? Drum? And And then I got caught up in that now, because I did it that one time or two time, and then I couldn't stop, because people, jump solo, jump solo. Okay. And then it became a part of the show, you know? Yeah. Even though I was reprimanded a couple of times, bro, The show done, you know. Not Peter, because Peter never care, you know what I mean? But the musical MD at the time, Keith Sweeney, was like, yo, the show done, you know what? So I mean, what the people want it, so. But then they just allowed me to do it. Because Peter was the most laid-back individual. Him don't care. Him, you know, he's not going to tell you, oh, you're doing this or you do it. He's just part of it. He loves it. He did his job. And if you want to do that, it ain't going to take nothing out for him for you to do that. But that was that.
Rastafari. Rastafari. I tell you. I recently saw some kind of advertisement saying Soul Syndicate's supposed to be going to Europe. And me see your picture. And me see Fully and
Balaban and Pony and Chin and something. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I am not sure about that. I don't know if I'm going to be able to do all that. You know what I mean? I don't know. Because, you know, Soul Syndicate haven't done any new project in a while, you know? And for me, I don't like too much of the nostalgic kind of thing where you're playing some songs that was, I mean, it's cool. People want to hear it, but I think it would be much, I think there'll be much more if we had some new songs, you know, some fresh songs today, you know what I mean? But I don't know. I don't know what the plan is. I kind of heard about it too, but you know, I don't know what's going on, you know? The thing is this, my thing is, when I do anything, I wanna make sure it's concrete. It's not just a hustle, or, you know? Not that I'm saying it's a hustle, but I don't know, you know? You know, I don't know. I
mean, you as a songwriter, are you writing any new tunes these days?
Oh, yeah. Right now, I was working on stuff before I tuned into you guys, yeah. Like I tell you, I have those albums out. You know what I mean? I have stuff out. You know, it's on you. Like I tell you, you go on online, you will see stuff. I got stuff out there.
Can you name a couple? We can pull it up now.
There's an album. I forgot to tell you about this one. I did this one. When did I release this? I released this in this was 2015. It's called Watch Your Liberty. Was that 15?
Watch Your Liberty.
Watch Your Liberty, like live, but I said liberty. You know where that's yeah. This album was released 2015. I was just doing stuff. I don't know if you can see it.
Okay, Watch Your Liberty. Okay, Watch Your
Liberty. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Watch Your Liberty. Mm-hmm. And then I did this was the first one I did. This was the first one.
Dizone.
Right?
Uh-huh.
And where is it? I think I have something else. Let me see. I think this. Really? Oh yeah, this is a late. Let me take that. So let me wrap off on this thing.
Yes.
Yeah. See.
Check it.
This is the latest one.
Check
Africa
it.
Africa is my home.
Do you like how you're living? Do you like how you're living? Watch your liberty. Miss Effie, watch your liberty. Watch your liberty. Miss Effie, watch your liberty. Cause you're somewhere, can become nowhere. You're somewhere, can become nowhere in a minute. So watch your liberty. your liberty. Me say fi watch your liberty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, man. I learned from the greats, you know.
So who was that's you on the league?
Yeah.
That sounds like Muta Baruka.
Yeah.
That's nice.
It's funny, I'm doing lead and I'm playing all the instruments except the guitars.
All right.
Yeah, man, I'm gonna play everything, man. Everything. Cause I'm in my little lab, you know, so I'm here by myself and mm-hmm. everything is kind of close quarters. So mm-hmm. I just keep putting things on. Everything is live. There's no machines. No machine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, man. So, yeah, man, you know. So I'm working on some new stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm. Do you get a chance to visit schools? And if you don't, would you be interested in sharing your music with children?
Of course, if that comes up and it's organized, right? I mean, you know, because that's our job, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have a responsibility, you know, as adults, you know. And if we want to make change, then it's something that we have to do, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, man. Yeah, man. If that comes up, that would be great, yeah. This kind of jazzy, this kind of like a jazzy.
Sound good, man.
Kind of remind me. I was kind of inspired by my. Yeah, man.
Really nice. Very nice.
Yeah, like you know. Yeah. But the latest one, Africa. Oh, what there's this one. Yeah, the latest one is called "Thy Will Be Done." Thy Will Be Done. It's do I have it? Yes, I put out 4 CDs, man. But you know, because times are different now, you got to promote your own stuff. But yeah, one it's called "Thy Will Be Done." I don't know. Might have fell back around there. But the latest one is called "Thy Will Be Done." If you go, you'll find it online. All right.
That's beautiful. Yeah.
Spiritual vibe, you know. I can't do any less than that, you know. If I'm not going to do something to at least uplift someone's spirit, then I'm not going to do it, you know. You know, I'm not singer like some people, but if the words come to me and I just say, okay, and that is just like a mantra, you know what I mean? Like a meditation, kind of repeat, get it in your system. To God be the glory. Thy will be done, you know. Yeah.
Very nice.
Yeah, bro.
Were you a member or did you work with Ross Michael?
Of course. That's who I grew. He was like my daddy.
Okay.
Yeah. That's daddy are like the big brother I never had.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And Ross Michael helped to shape people like me, you know what I mean? From going on the wrong side too, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So Ross Michael was a very good influence,
mm-hmm.
you know? Good person to be around, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I learned so much from him, you know, the whole Naya Bingi vibe and
mm-hmm.
the spiritual culture vibe. Yeah, man. Ross Michael play a great, great role for people like me and Chyna Smith and many others, you know? Yeah, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. This was
in Jamaica when you first started working with him?
Oh, yeah.
He was influenced from Jamaica.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, man. We did something. Let me tell you something. We were down in Negril one time. And we were playing some music, doing some chant, and they were having like a concert thing going on. And we were backstage somewhere on the beach, right? And we were smoking a lot of weed, right? And I mean, the police was there. Something strange happened. We were smoking, but we were kind of exposed to the people, kind of. This police superintendent, he brought about maybe 6 or 8 cops to stand in front of us to shield us from the people.
While you were playing?
While we were smoking.
Oh, while you were smoking. Oh, okay.
I mean, it was one of the funniest thing. We were, and this is in the 70s. But, and we, Ross Michael, we were the first Rasta group to play inside the police academy. There was a police academy down in Spanish Town, and we played in there. But that place, because it was a police training school, Mr. Weekly, he came and said, "Please don't smoke any herb here today because of the students." He asked us not to smoke, but there was another place that we smoked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, remember, smoking weed in Jamaica back then was an offense.
Yeah, that's right.
You know what I mean? But there was a respect. Ross Michael garnered a lot of respect. You know what I mean? So they allowed us to do that. But he begged us not to smoke.
When
he played at the training school, where the police training school, he begged, "Please don't smoke here today because I don't want the student to get exposed to that." I said,
mm-hmm.
"All right, Mr. Weekly, no problem."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So yeah, man. You know, Ross has always been good, even up to this day. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I talk to him like every other day. You know what I mean? So yeah, Ross has been very influential. You know,
mm-hmm.
as far as us young ones coming up. You know, so mm-hmm. I forgive him, give him respect for that. You know,
mm-hmm.
yeah, man.
Santa, my phone just ring a second ago.
Yeah.
I check it. It's Isachar. He said, "For hail you up."
Ah, nice.
Cool. Yes. He said, tell him I can't talk to him right now because we'll do this with Santa David. He said, "What? Hail him up for us."
Come on.
Do you have any future endeavors, things that you would like to do, complete, be a part of on your journey of music?
Well, it's kind of funny, you know. I kind of like leave things. I don't really think.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of like the bird who just flies, you know. And I see a landing spot. I don't really think about things too much.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of leave it and let the spirit direct. You know, like a spiritual direction. So if something, you know, things will always come. And it comes in its own time,
mm-hmm.
and kind of like you get the inspiration, like, okay, yeah, this is cool. I know this is not cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't. to be honest, I don't really make a lot of plans, because sometimes you make plans and it might not even be what you want to do. It might not be even something. So I just kind of leave it to the spiritual vibe, you know, and just move with that spirit. You know what I mean? Yeah. So I don't really make a lot of plans like that.
So do any of our listeners that are joining us right this time, does anybody have any questions for Mr. Santa Davis or any comments at this time? If so, please speak.
I forever hold your peace.
I know Stevie, I'm muted.
Well, I'm dear Stevie. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I'm enjoying the interview, you know. I just enjoy the vibes.
Yeah. Yeah, man. I mean, you know, this is a very interesting journey, man. And you know, I really, as I say, I really appreciate, you know, the people, a lot of the people who have worked it over the years. So yeah, man. So I consider myself very fortunate.
It looked like Jinjay's son right there has some.
Yeah.
Man, I respect. You can hear me?
Yeah, man. Yeah, I hear you, man.
I think you know the whole thing, and I give thanks to all of the, you know, it's very spray, you know. From day one, and I respect you from a come up, from a look at you, and I come up, you know, so it's always love.
Yeah, man, every time.
Yes,
family. Yeah, man. Enough respect, family. All right, sir. Bless.
That's my son, Jesse.
Yeah, man.
He was mesmerized at the show Santa Una Do when you bring Andrew Tosh.
Okay.
And he must sit on the stage. Mm-hmm. And he must just watch you, you know. He watch you, and then me, I look upon him, and it looked like he would get, you know, dizzy. Mm-hmm. Him just watch you, and him start play drum. That's when him just start play drum, man. He was about 3 years old at them time there.
Yeah. 3 or 4 years. And that man saying, you see, my whole thing from ever since, and that's why I'm always to the people, you know, be careful what you put down, you know, because you have your kids, right? And you teach them, you give them all of the wisdom and the knowledge from home. When them come on the street, them coming to us. So now it's our responsibility now to give them the same treatment, make sure, say, you know, give them something positive. So, you know, because all the set of people, the kids, them going to come up, you know, them going to grow up, you know, and them going to ask questions, you know. Them going to ask questions. Why did you do that? What were you thinking when you wrote that song? You know, what influenced you to do such and such? You see what I'm saying? So it is very, very important for us to make sure we set example for the young ones. You know what I mean? Because what I want to see, I want to make sure if I influence, I want to play drums. I even just play music, period. That is it for me, because that is more reward for me than money. Because at least, you know, say, may I help lead a child in the right direction. You know what I mean? So it's very, very important for us as musicians to make sure, say, we spread the right message. Right. We spread, you know, with the right frequency. You know what I mean? Yeah. Come on. Very important.
Brother Ernest, did you have a comment or a question?
No, it was just that he brought back to mind when I came up young, but I came up like in the 50s and 60s. And heard Bob, because when he mentioned High Tide and Low Tide, that was one of my favorite songs. And he said he played on that. That got my attention. You know?
Yeah.
But you were talking about the groups and sessions and stuff. And I came up when I was a teenager. We had a group came up with, and I remember all the sessions you talking about.
Right.
Jam sessions, trying to get together. And
oh, yeah.
I sang with these guys from like the mid-50s, right, from about 1954 up to about 61. Mm-hmm. Then I got drafted in the military, and then I left the group, and they went on, toured around, and went to a lot of different places. And
yeah,
they put out a couple of songs, but it never really got big hits out of it, you know.
Right.
But yeah, but that brought back a lot of memories when you said about Bob, because that's kind of been my favorite, you know, because most of the music I got is just Bob and Peter Tosh and Bunny Livingston and those.
Yeah,
really, really interesting, though, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I mean, man, I consider myself privileged to have worked with those brethren, you know, work with them as a group, and then work with them individually, you know what I mean? So it's like, you know, and then working with their kids, you know what I mean? It's like, you don't get no better than that.
Yeah.
Well, I did love the work of Peter Tosh. I think he's an excellent lyricist. Mm-hmm. His music, I remember hearing Tosh play a song, a version. It's the same song Bob did. But you see, by the way Tosh do it, me never, it wasn't until the end of the song that I realized it was the song Bob. Well, they must have did it when they were young.
Which one? Get Up, Stand Up?
No, sir. It's a slower one. It's
okay.
Sure. I still remember the name. Talked about.
Well, I'll tell you one that I really like is and Bushman did a real good job with it. Xavier. Yeah, that's a beautiful song.
Yeah, man.
Oh, I love it. Love it.
You play on that one, Santa?
No. That was Carly Barrett.
All right.
I think it was Carly Barrett. That was the time. That was back in the day when, you know, he could use Carly. You know, there were session players back then.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess, you know, when Bob decided that he wanted to have his own sound, he was like, yo, well, for lack of me, you know, okay, I'm at the sound, go all over the place. So that's when they became exclusive Bob Marley musician, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But they recorded with Bonnie and Peter. But was Carly Barrett playing that, man? Yeah, man. Great Carly Barrett.
Let y'all be praised.
Yeah. For real, man.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We recently lost another part of reggae royalty, Stephen Catcore.
Is
that
yeah.
someone that you had an opportunity to play with? And
I don't remember. I don't think I ever get to like perform with him, but I've known Cat for years, man. I have maximum respect because you know. He was one of the contributors, you know, to the music, and multi-talented as far as playing guitar and the cello and, you know what I mean, sing, you know. So, you know, Catcore, yeah, man, much respect. I mean, he made his contribution, you know, and, you know, that's it. You know, he don't have anything but, you know, I mean, good thing to say about people like that because he contributed to the genre in a great way, you know? Yeah, man. Much respect. Yeah, man.
And Jimmy Cliff, we lost him not too long ago.
Yes. Yeah, I worked with Jimmy Cliff. Actually, the first, 76. Yeah. That was the first time. Jimmy Cliff was the first time I came to New York.
Oh.
Back in January of 1976. I remember coming to New York when it was freezing cold.
Oh my God.
And I'm coming from the islands. Don't have, because I've never been in the cold before. So I came to the US, no winter jacket, no this, that. And somebody said to me, bro, you gotta get your jacket, man. You can't do this. You will die in this thing. I said, okay. So I went to I found this army surplus store. And they had like, because I used to love military stuff. So I bought this military jacket. And it was a down jacket, you know. Mm-hmm. I put it on and said, yeah, okay. Now I'm warm. And then there was a store. You remember this store they used to have called Roots? They used to sell shoes and stuff like that. In New York, they had just opened a store. So I was walking and then I see this store named the Roots. I said, oh, let me go in. And they had some nice boots and stuff. So I said, I'm gonna try that boot and stuff. And so I started telling them the price. And then they found out that we were on tour with Jimmy Cliff. And the guy was like, no, man, you don't have to pay for that. Just take it. And tell Jimmy Cliff to come over. I give him some stuff too. Because they had just opened. So I got one of these big boots, you know, to keep my foot warm. So I was set.
Yeah.
When they got me some long johns and I was ready to go.
Yeah, that had to be a shocker.
Yeah, man. But I did. I worked with Jimmy Cliff out of 76. And I think he was the first Jamaican musician to actually do a live show. We did a live show in Central Park. I think that was the first time they ever did something like that. Like tape a live show. Like with a reggae band. I think we were the first reggae band to tape a live show. And they did a bunch of cameras in Central Park. Yeah. So I toured with him for all that year. And then I went on, did some other things, went back to Soul Syndicate. And then I think in the 80s, I think I did something with him like maybe 84, 84, 85 or something like that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
I think what might have been 84. Yeah. Might have been 84 because Peter had just taken a break. We had come off the road 1983 mm-hmm. and he said he's going to take a break to get himself back together. And then 84, I did some, yeah. So I work with him, you know. It was real cool. I got a lot of good inspiration from Jimmy Cliff too, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All these people, I kind of collected different vibe, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about Jimmy, he was really into the culture too. He was into the same truth and rights kind of vibe, mm-hmm. consciousness, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So kind of keep that trend, you know, to mm-hmm. work with people who I can learn something from, because that mm-hmm. that will help me, you know, so I can help other people.
Right.
So this is why I try not to distort that energy by working with anybody, you know what I mean? I have to make sure I'm very selective who I hang with, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The song was called Fools Die.
Okay.
Fools Die, and I never know it have the same lyrics as Stiff-Necked Fools, but the way Peter arranged it, I didn't even recognize it until almost the end of the song.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Oh, it's something that he did. He was playing the piano thing. It was kind of like a ballad, right?
Yes.
An acoustic. It was an acoustic thing, and he was playing the piano and singing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
Yeah, man. Beautiful. Peter was deep, man. It was deep when it come to the old vibe and the culture, you know? Real deep.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I think it's not until I heard the lyrics of Stiff-Necked Fool that I realized, those I recognize those lyrics from a Bob Marley song. So I'm like, but it's the way him arranged it. It just blew me away. I love his militancy. I love how he wrote. I love how he commanded language.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Come on.
Mm-hmm. And I loved how you played drums with him. That's
yeah, man. Was good. You see, it's not let's say iron sharp, not iron enough. So when you work with people that inspire you, it mm-hmm. inspire you to play good. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know they. You know working with people like that make me sound good.
Mm-hmm.
So I get inspired by them, and then I can do what I do. You know. So
yeah, I remember the night that Garty introduced me to Tosh and introduced me to Vision Dream.
Yeah.
Vision Dream, a play.
Yeah, man.
What happened to him?
He's up. He's up in San Francisco. I mean, up in Oakland, I think. Yeah, I just did well a couple of months back, maybe a year ago. I did something, you know, with him. He came and he did he had a song and he did a video, and he called me to do the video with him. So
what?
Yeah.
And I love to see that. Don't even read to Marley's cousin.
Yeah, if they family. Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yes, man. Boy, the history is deep.
Yeah, man. I mean, there's so much, you know. There's so much involvement, and when you find that you actually worked with these people, and you actually knew them, you know, like you know, Bob was my brethren, you know, Peter was my brethren, but you don't go around and say these things, but people don't know, you know. But mm-hmm. I'm not the type of person who, you know, brag on those things. Bob was just an ordinary dude. Peter was just the same. Bunny, it was just like, you know, they didn't see themselves as superstars and celebrity and all.
Well, I don't know. Jabi did.
Ah! I mean, yeah, he was cool, you know. He was cool, you know.
I love Jabi. I really get to know him well when I lived in Jamaica. His children mm-hmm. call me auntie, you know?
Right.
Them used to clown with me. But, mm-hmm. yeah, man, the history, I selfishly do this podcast, Virgin Santa, just so I could stay close to my king, man. Eh?
Yeah, man.
I feel him when I talk to them. Because
right.
it's the same energy coming from that time.
Right, and right.
So I really give thanks, Santa, that you take time from your very busy schedule to sit with I and I, because we are on Seventh Heaven tonight. Hey, Rashiki and Mashriki.
Oh, most definitely.
Come on. It's
always a good treat to sit with extraordinary people like yourself, Brother Santa.
Yeah, man. Respect, man. Appreciate it. Yeah, man. Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. You know, it's nice to do because I don't do this often. You know, like, you know what I mean? But it's nice to be able to, you know, have a conversation sometime, you know?
And, you deserve your flowers, Brendan. I want you to know that.
Yeah, man.
I want you to know that.
Yeah, man. I just see myself as one of the contributors. You know what I mean? Because I and a lot, because there's a lot of musicians that did so much, you know, and didn't get their flowers. You know what I mean? Nobody knew about them. You know what I mean? There were people that was that mentor to me, you know. I grew up listening to them, learn from them. You know, you have drummers like Hugh Malcolm, you know. He was one of the top drummers in Jamaica. Nobody knew about these people. You know what I mean? Of course, Winston Grenham. You know, John Bago. There was a lot of musicians that really set the table for us, you know. Lyde Nibbs, of course, you know. I mean, Winston Brivett, you know. Lyde Brivett. All them people, they contributed, I mean, so much to the genre, you know. And nobody knew about them because, you know, at the time when we came into business, you know, a lot of those guys didn't do touring. When we came into business, we started touring. You know, it was a different different time. It was the 70s now. You know, these musicians are coming from the 40s and the 50s, you know what I mean? And the 60s. And they were the ones who set the foundation for us, for me, so that I could have something, a platform to work off of, you know? And every chance I get, I always like to shine the light on them, you know what I mean? Because they are the ones who set the foundation, you know? And even though a lot of them not here today, mm-hmm. you know, Tommy McCook and the Roland Alfonso's and, you know, you name it, you know, the Jackie Mitoos and, mm-hmm. you know, I learned so much from hanging with those people, going in the studios with them, learning from them, you know what I mean? And to see what they did and to where we have taken it, you know what I mean? So I know they will be proud, you know? They will be proud to see what us musicians did to establish it to the level that it's at, you know? But they are the ones who started it. Mm-hmm. They are the foundations, you know what I mean? So,
yep. There's the passing of the baton.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This is a relay, a life relay.
Yeah. And that's the same thing I'm doing, you know?
Yeah.
I'm making sure, you know, I have a lot of kids that I've been doing shows and I would just spot one kid standing there in the audience. And when I'm done, I would give him a pair of stickers. You know? And I know that kid's going to be the future, you know? Mm-hmm. Like my bass player who plays with Ziggy, right? He has a little son, Brandon, right? Brandon is playing drums right now. He's playing good drums. And I remember when he was a baby in his pampers, I gave him a pair of sticks, right? And his mom was calling me, Santa, what did he do? Brandon is running all over the house chasing us with his sticks. And now he's an accomplished drummer. He's playing right now. He's reading music. He's playing. You see what I'm saying? So the thing is this, and the funny part, I didn't get any tutoring from any drummer, you know? I hear people are trying to say, Arse Mouth taught me. I said, Arse Mouth never showed me nothing, you know? I learned all my rudiments from drum corps. That's where I learned. And my teachers was the greats, the Art Blakeleys, the Elvin Jones, you know, the Purdy's, Max Roach. Max Roach, it's funny, Max Roach was the first American drummer I heard about when I was a kid. Because back in Jamaica, they used to, these older guys used to play a lot of jazz. They love jazz in Jamaica, even to this day. And they used to have these records. And one time, you know, I was somewhere and they were playing some music. And I said, oh, that's Max Roach. Max Roach. And Max Roach? Said, oh, that's bad drummer, man. Bad drummer. And I said, Max Roach. Shoot, I might have been about 8, 9 years old. And they're talking about Max Roach. So that's the first time I've ever heard. And it was, back then they didn't have videos, right? He's the record and I would listen and hearing those chops. And, okay, nice, you know? So I got exposed to greatness before I even knew that I could play drums, you know? So I learned from the greats, man. And it's, you know, I consider myself fortunate that I'm where I'm at. So just like I say, I have to give, you know, praise, and I have to give thanks and give all those people who were before me, you know? And it's for me now to pass it on to someone else, you know? Yeah. That's like I say, it's a big relay, you know? We keep passing the baton, you know? Yeah.
So did you ever work with maybe Monty Alexander or Scatolites or anything like that?
I worked with Monty, like when, not recording session, but mm-hmm. I did some live show where mm-hmm. where he's doing, he came to L.A., and he did a couple of things, and I went somewhere back east with him too, but he would do the jazz thing, he would mm-hmm. play these songs in jazz, mm-hmm. and then I take over the reggae section and we play the reggae, do that, and then go back to the jazz thing. So I like that, you know, it was fun. So, yeah. I spoke to him, a couple, maybe a year ago or so, you know. Yeah, man.
Great.
But I never actually did like a recording session, but I worked with him and it's fun, you know, learning from a musician like that, you know. And he's telling me all the great people he played with, like,
everyone. You know,
he played with a lot of the great ones. I think he worked with Frank Sinatra and all of
people. Yeah, he's played with a lot of people.
I said, what?
For those that don't know, Monty Alexander is a jazz pianist from Jamaica, but he does a lot of work here in the United States. Plays with
oh yeah, oh yeah.
What about Ernest Ranglin?
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. I used Ernest to, Franklin's a guitar player.
Yes, we used to work with Jimmy Cliff together, you know. Mm-hmm. And the first time I did a commercial, it was with him. It was a bank in Jamaica. I think it's called a Canadian Imperial Bank of Commerce. Mm-hmm. And he did this this little jingle for the bank, like a thing, and I did that with him. I said, wow, that was cool. You know? Mm-hmm. He called me and said, oh, we're going to do this jingle for this bank. I said, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. But yeah, man. Yeah, Ernie Ranglin, man. Yeah.
Yeah, man. What about Dean Frazier, the saxophone?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Did a lot of work with, you know, like, worked with him, you know, live shows and, you know, studio stuff. Yeah, man.
So
yeah, man, all those musicians, man.
A very well-rounded drummer. You're not, I mean, you happen to play rocksteady reggae, but you play more than just one genre of music.
I even did a song with Chaka Khan, you know. Yeah. You remember that program they used to have, I think it was this guy, LeVar Burton. Reading Rainbow. There
yes,
was
yes, yes. Thing. Uh-huh.
And then I was working with Eddie Griffin. Eddie Griffin was doing his TV show, but he used to
Eddie
like
Griffin,
to do
the comedian.
The comedian. And he used to like to do the P-Funk kind of things. So I used to be working with him. And we used to perform at, I remember that place right there on Sunset called the Coconut Teaser.
Yeah.
It was right at Crescent and Sunset. Was right.
So
at
it's
the
had a lot of names then. It's had other
Yeah, they
names
changed the name, but I don't know what it is.
Is that
now.
The candy
but,
store also or something?
I don't know. But at the time it was called a Coconut Teaser. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we used to do that. So we were doing a session one time what's the name? Not Columbia. It wasn't Columbia. Anyway, we were in the studios and she was doing some things with him too, right? So she sang the song, but then, you know, she played a little drum too, you know.
Drums,
so
yes.
So she was playing the drums, but it had a lot of chops in it, you know, where she was having difficulty. So I just walked in the studio and she saw me, she said, oh, Sandra, I'm glad you're here. Could you please play this for me? And then I ended up playing on the song, the Reading Rainbow. Da, 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 da. And I played one take, because there was a producer. And I listened to the song. And he said, you ready? I said, yeah, I'm ready. Boom, one take. And she was happy. So I can say I played a track for Chaka. Yeah. And I did a live show with her one time. It was a little thing we did. And she was singing that Don Penn song. No. So I can say on my resume, I said, okay, I played on a track for her and I did a show with her. So I'm not lying.
No, that's good. Anybody else have any questions?
We have this person on that's on the iPhone. Can you unmute and identify yourself if you don't mind? I've been wanting to know. Who that was?
Yeah, who is it?
And he's not telling you.
I spy.
Could be they're not coming on. Okay.
They shy, but it's okay.
Okay.
Thanks for coming anyway. I spy.
Yeah, people just want to listen sometimes. It's cool. But yeah, man, it has always been a great journey. Shoot, I even get to do stuff with Willie Nelson. I did an album with Willie, right? Mm-hmm. But the company wanted him to do some new songs. So he came to the studio and he started singing some of his older songs. Like he just said, I'm going to sing some of my older songs that I recorded before, you know? I don't think the record company liked that, but he did it anyway.
Me, Willie Nelson.
But he was real cool though, you know. You run into a lot of big top musicians and stuff, and they kind of have an attitude, and you know. But he was cool to the point where, you know, country and western singers, those guys, they kind of like one strike of the chord, and then they start singing, mm-hmm. and. The moment I rolled out the song, he started singing. So I have to stop and I said, "Hey, Willie, you know what? Why don't you let us play like a 4-bar intro and then you come in, you know?" And he was cool about it. He was like, no, this is how I want to do it. He was like, "Oh, okay, cool, you know." Because yeah. I was kind of saying, let the rhythm introduce first and do a 4-bar thing and then you come in. And he was cool about that, you know? So I'm like, it's nice working with people like that who don't have inflated ego, you know, like,
yeah.
You know, I mean, he was real cool and he was
comfortable,
stuff.
He comfortable with the skin he in and who he is,
right, you know. So that was real cool, you know, Run into a bunch of people, man, that you know, in the business, you know, they, you know, yeah, but I just, you know, what, man, I love what I do, and you know, I just love to see when I do a show with someone, you know, and see the smile, you know, mm-hmm. and the compliment that someone would come to you and say, "Oh man, you guys were great. I enjoyed it. I can go home feeling good." You know what I mean? So, you know, just simple thing that make me feel good. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. you know, people always come to me and they say, "Oh man, you're the greatest drummer and stuff." I say, "Well." Can't say, yeah, like people would say, "Oh, you're the greatest reggae drummer," and I'm like, "No, not like that. It's a big group of us. I'm just one of the participants. I'm just one of the people who, you know, there's a lot of us who contributed to this, you know, reggae experience." Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So you know, someone said to me, I don't know if it was Steve who said it to me one time, like, "Well, you don't know what you did to that person, why they think of you as the greatest." You know what I mean?
That's true. That's true.
I think it was Steve who said that to me one time. And I was like,
But
I said, it's like you don't want to burst, right? You don't want to burst someone's bubble. You know what I mean? So
you're definitely showing your humility.
Yeah, but it's true because I can't take credit for everything, because I'm just one of the guys. I'm like, I always tell people, I am one of the link in the chain. You know what I mean? I'm not the whole chain. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a bunch of us who contribute to reggae music. So, you know, when somebody comes to me and says, "Oh, you're the greatest reggae drummer," I'm like, "No." Yeah. So if I'm the greatest, then what about those other guys? Mm-hmm. They're the greatest too, because we all contribute to the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So, you know,
we might play different. We might have different approach. But I really can't take that credit by thinking, "Oh, it gets to my head in a way. Oh yeah, I'm the greatest cricketer." I can't do that. It's hard for me to accept it like that, you know?
It's definitely a unit, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, we all contribute to this. Every reggae drummer, our musician, if that guy only played on one song, he did his part. Mm-hmm. If he only played one song in his whole life for the genre, mm-hmm. you know, he contributed to it. He made something happen for this particular thing. So it's a big troop of us, and we all contribute, you know what I mean, to make it what it is today. Mm-hmm. So I'm just one of the guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm just one of the guys. Really, I'm not gonna, you know, because people say that, and I get this uneasy feeling because I don't want people to think that, oh, I believe that, because I can't, you know what I mean? But as I say, someone said to me, this person saying that you are the greatest, to them, you are the greatest drummer, then maybe you might have to leave it at that, because you might not know what you did for that person,
right,
why they
right.
feel that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But on a whole, if somebody come on the internet or, you know, on some news reel and say, oh, well, Santa Davis are in a live, like you're doing a live show. Mm-hmm. And somebody goes, well, we have here the greatest reggae drummer of all time. Like, no.
Yeah,
no.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And the last gig I saw you on was with Fully, and I watched your drum setup. And was a little different than what most drummers I see, because you had everything, your own everything, own mic on everything. I didn't see it being a part of everything else. Could you just speak a little bit on how your drum setup is when you're doing live compared to maybe general, what people might generally use?
Well, okay, so it all depends. Like when I'm doing, like normally, like when I'm working with Ziggy, I have a full drum set. So I have like, And it was the same thing like with Peter Tosh. I used to have four rack toms, timbali, and a floor tom.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it's about four rack across, timbali, and a floor tom.
Mm-hmm.
Then I would have some electric. Back in those days, we used to use those little syndromes, those electronic pads, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, like with Ziggy, I'm just rolling with three rack toms, one floor tom, a timbali, and a bunch of cymbals, you know? But it just depends, because I can play with any kind of configuration. I don't know, only when I work with Zig, because range of motion and things that I do, certain things, I need those toms in order to fold. But I can still do without them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a setup. If I'm doing like little gigs around town, it just depends. I might have one rack and a floor tom and a timbali, snare and, you know, kick drum and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So it just depends, because, you know, a drum set, you know, you take a long time to set that up.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm doing, when I'm on the road with Zig, you know, we have a drum tech. So I don't have to set nothing up.
Mm-hmm.
It's being set up. But when I'm doing my thing, it just depends. I might roll with two rack toms and a floor tom, timbali, cymbal, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my playing is adjusted by what my configuration is. So I can use any kind of configuration and still play to maximum effect, but it just depends, you know? Whenever I'm doing like a big show where I need, you know, coloring, you know what I mean? Then I might have to use like, okay, I need three rack toms and floor toms and stuff like that, you know? So, yeah, that's basically the setup. But, you know, I mean, I can play with any setup. I can play with no rack toms and still, you know, keep the beat going, you know? So, yeah. So it's not like, okay, I'm married to, because you might go someplace, like they say, okay, we're renting some stuff. And you might go there and it might not be what you need. So you end up with minimal stuff. I say, okay, I'm cool. I'm not going to be crying like a baby. Oh, no, I wanted this. No, I'm going to use what I see, you know? Yeah. And that's how I do it. I try not to be too specific on stuff, because things might change, you know? So I kind of, but when I'm going anywhere, if somebody say, oh, they have a drum set, I still carry my snare. I still carry my foot pedal.
Mm-hmm.
I carry my trone, and I carry my timbali and my cymbals.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm still carrying things,
mm-hmm.
and of course my stick bag, you know what I mean?
Yes, that's
so
right.
I'm carrying my essentials that, you know, I want to make sure I have it. Because I play a certain type of cymbals,
mm-hmm.
and my pedal, you know, my seat, I'm very, you know, weird when it comes to... Particularly when it comes to drum throne. Yeah. I just want to be sitting on everybody's drum show. So
that's right.
I travel with my own. And you see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I travel with essentials. Like the carpenter don't go to work without his tools, right? The mechanic come to fix your car and he's asking you for tools. Nah.
I just happen to be observing. You know, I see a lot of musicians, a lot of drummers.
No.
Observing your setup and how your mics and everything work. And I know that's not, most people don't set up like that.
Yeah, I mean, it depends. It depends on how important you see your job. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And it is very important to me in order for me to give the audience, because you, the audience pay their money. They don't pay to come to see some mediocre stuff. And a lot of time you have musicians who, the way, you know, I like to carry my stuff covered. Like you bring your stuff in a bag and it looks uniform. People, you have guys that just come with a bunch of stuff and it looks like, where did you get that? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it looks kind of like you're not professional. Mm-hmm. And for me, I have a certain amount of professionalism that I have to, you know, bring to the thing. So I'm presenting something to you. I don't want you standing there looking like, you know, what is that? You know, no. I just make sure I do it.
Do you have some endorsements, right?
Not much. The only endorsement I have now is with a stick company out of Italy called Tecra. Tecra Carbon, they're like carbon fiber sticks. And then I've been with Sabian Cymbals since 95. Mm-hmm. Okay. So those are the only two. The drum company, I mean, I don't really care much about drum company because, you know, they kind of like, they already have a lot of people. Everybody wants a drum endorsement. I'm like, you know what? I don't care. Just give me a drum set. I'll play any kind of drum set. You know, it don't matter to me, you know? Because one time I was supposed to get like a DW, because I play a DW kit right now with Ziggy, but I was supposed to get, I went down to DW, talked to the guys, da, 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 da. But sometimes they're kind of weird, you know? And I see, you know, I don't want to do what I don't want to do to get anything. So I say, keep your stuff. I got my stuff. I work with this, you know? So, but it's all good. But I've been endorsed with Sabian since 95, and you know, mm-hmm. and then I have this stick company, carbon fiber. Mm-hmm. It's cool. Yeah.
No, that's great. That's great.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like it's almost been 3 hours
since we've been talking. I'm hungry now. Yeah.
So on behalf of all of us, thank you so much for your time, for sharing your musical career with us, taking the time out to do that. We all really appreciate it. And I look forward to you have anything that you're going to be releasing that you let us know so you can, you know, come here and talk about it.
Oh, yeah. It's my pleasure, man. It was really good. I really enjoyed it, you know.
And if anybody wants to take a look at your website or hear your music or anything, what should they go to? Is there a website or is there something? Are you on Instagram or are you on Threads or are you on Blue Sky?
I think my SantaDavis.com, I think. But I think I'm going to have to check with my I make sure it's still up, you know, then I just,
right.
you know, make sure, because I know it's supposed to be up, but I haven't done any updates, so.
And do you have any shows or anything around in the area coming up?
Not at the moment, no.
No, so, okay, Soul Syndicate is not playing right now in Laguna Beach or anything?
No, you know, so.
And if that changes, then whatever you have, please let us know also, because we'll still, you know, promote it. Let people know so we can come check you out.
Oh, yes. Yeah. We'd love to go out and check out shows and take pictures.
You know? Yeah, most definitely. If it's in range, we'd like to come to it.
We'll show up.
Right. All right. Cool. No problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, appreciate you, brother.
I appreciate this, Santa. Give thanks so much, because like I said, you know, I love you from my heart. I love the history.
Yes,
and it just brings me close to good brother guy. So
yeah, man. Give thanks. Right. It was my pleasure, and thanks to everyone, you know, for having me here, and much love and blessings to everyone, you know?
Yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. And yes, thank you to everybody who came out this evening, and yes, we're going to keep doing this, and hopefully we get a chance to get Santa back home.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah, man.
All right. Appreciate it.
I kind of like this.
That's good.
Well, we really appreciate you being here, most definitely.
We do. Yes, we do.
All right. Right. We'll definitely keep in touch. No problem.
Yeah, when the brethren it's all together, it definitely, Mashriki will definitely forward it to you so you can.
Right. Yeah, that's right. When it's finished,
right,
we'll send
it.
Yeah, no problem, man. Bless
you. Okay. All right. Parting greetings to everybody. Everybody continue the great day.
Rastafari, Rastafari family.
All right.
And give thanks, Ernest, every time you there's giving us support. I really appreciate it.
Yes, Elder Brother.
That's right.